This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 193, He's a Fake! I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Larry Nemechek. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Geek Nation tours, the anniversaries of the voyage home and First Contact, and the curious case of Vince Dedrick's chair. Then in the feature, we're joined by Charlene Schmidt and Brandon Shea Mutala to discuss the Voyager episode, Deadlock. So let's step into The Ready Room. Hello, Larry. It's great to have you back here with me once again on The Ready Room as we're heading into the end of football season and looking at how things are shaping up. Are we going to have to get our Ambojutsu image back out once again from a couple of years ago?
That crazy college football playoff. Let's just throw everybody for a loop here and go in an alternate universe and do a whole college football.
Okay, well, that's when the show becomes the locker room.
Maybe we should, yeah, the locker room. Yeah, no. I have my Ambojutsu pants put up on a little trophy plaque here on the side of the wall, but yeah. I guess we shouldn't.
For those who haven't seen this, of course, I'm an Alabama fan. Larry's an Oklahoma fan. 2 years ago, we played each other.
I was born in Norman. I'm not just a fan.
Not just a fan, yeah. And I went to the University of Alabama. And anyway, I took the scene of Riker and his dad doing Ambojutsu in the Icarus Factor, and I photoshopped Larry and me. Well, supposed to be Larry and me in our school colors there for a little Star Trek college football connection, and we had fun with that. So anyway, yeah. It looks like we might be heading that way again.
And if it works out that way, I want you to do another one, because that was such a good luck sign. I just want the karma.
Yeah, because you won the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll do that this year, Larry. So
An incredible upset all time.
All right. But before that all takes shape, we're going to talk about some Star Trek events here. And there hasn't been a lot of news since our last show, but we did have two anniversaries pass. And those are for the releases of Star Trek IV and then also First Contact, which both happened in late November. The Voyage Home opened 29 years ago on November 26, 1986, and First Contact opened 19 years ago on November 22nd, 1996, which is really hard for me to believe because I remember going to the theater for both of these, but First Contact, I remember trying to go the first time and having a little bit of a car accident and having to delay my viewing until the following week. So, Larry, what are your memories of starting with Star Trek IV? Coming to theaters.
Well, here we go. These are 29 years, 29 and 19 years, because we are so into the 50th anniversary next year. But there's something about the I'm going to write something about this soon. There's something about the years ending in sixes for Star Trek, for major events happening. Mm-hmm. Because next year we'll have 30 years and 20 years anniversaries for these two movies, as well as the big 50 for the whole series. And for me personally, they're in way different parts of life. Star Trek IV was still in Oklahoma, was still working in news, but that summer I had gotten my independence up to where I wasn't just going to cons of wrath. I was actually going to good cons that worked, and went to a couple of Midwestern cons in Kansas City and St. Louis, both of which And, you know, kiddies, this is no bloody A, B, C, or D yet. It's the original series cast still. That is Star Trek. And D, who I was always thrilled to see, get to see as a fan watching from stage. D and Nichelle and Leonard were guests at one of these. And everybody was, in hindsight, I know this now, that they were so thrilled with Star Trek IV's, you know, the takes and the rushes and the dailies and all that. They were thrilled with the movie. They were thrilled with celebrating the 20th anniversary as a studio big hoo-ha thing with a party. They were talking to Gene about bringing a show back to TV, which turned into The Next Generation. All that was brewing in 86, and people were so up about it because they were so thrilled early on. You know, they couldn't show the world. They were previewing it here and there. But the talk and the buzz was so good, and it was that way in the summer. And there was a lot of stuff leaking out that we knew it was about whales and time travel and some wacky things. And it was pre-internet, so the cast could still be coy. You know, oh, I'm not talking about, you know. There was all of that little game kind of going on, but the stuff was coming out, and we knew bits and pieces. But it was still a really a delight and kind of an offbeat thing to see in theaters at the time. I just remember, I mean, I knew pieces. But it was still great and wonderful to see it. It was great to see everybody have their due. It was sad to figure that George got shorted, and then to find out a couple of reasons why, between a child actor and some other things that, you know, went wrong. But Jimmy and Dee had great bits, as well as, you know, everybody tromping around. And it was the first year that I realized I could get tax deductions if I actually went to conventions and interviewed people for business, for whatever.
Yeah.
Even though it was for my own newspaper. I didn't even think independent of my own. But no, so I, yeah, really, really fond. And I was rereading some, a letter zine called Interstat, and fandom was even thrilled because about a month to go, they moved up the premiere date. It was supposed to have been like the first week in December or something. For some reason, December 9th sticks in my mind. And they announced they were moving it up like a couple of weeks to take advantage of the Thanksgiving weekend. Again, because the buzz was so good internally, they were just busting to get it out. And there was just all kinds of great, you know, great vibe. And the news about Next Generation had just burst, and no one knew. It's like us talking about the new series on All Access CBS. No one knew what it was going to be, but there was all kinds of chatter and yakking, and the 10% loud vocal you know, fans were already about that. But that aside, that was what was in the water,
yeah.
You know, so you know, to speak.
I'm trying to remember because it's been so long since I watched the VHS tape, but do I remember correctly that when the VHS tape for The Voyage Home came out, did it have a preview of The Next Generation at the beginning
of
it?
Yes, because it was a few months later. I mean, the movie premiered on this time, but of course it was a few... In the slow motion world where, you know, the foreign premieres would be months later, you know, and the VHS tape came out, and they had shot enough footage from Farpoint by then to have a tease.
Yeah.
Which that was actually, now that you say about it, I talked about that in the Next Gen Companion because the Paramount guy did a whole marketing tape for all the affiliates and for licensees. And he goes through the whole lineup of the merchandising marketing that's going on. And one of them, you know, one of the best ones was they knew they'd be selling a gazillion Star Trek IV, you know, tapes between selling them the way they used to sell the sell through high price and the rentals, that they had this Next Gen commercial plopped right in the front of it. So they were all excited about, you know, getting that piggyback exposure. But yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. So back then when you were writing, about Star Trek sometimes for the paper that you were working for. That you weren't really covering Star Trek all the time at that point, right? You were doing other news stuff.
Yes, the Norman Transcript was a visionary vehicle, and we had a Star Trek beat writer years before it was. No, I just realized that if I went to a convention, I could I could somehow count the expenses off my taxes. You know, I did. I would write my editor would let me write a first, because my city editor, Hi Karen, was a fan too.
Okay.
And I would, instead of just running, you know, an AP story or somebody's feature off a syndicate, I would write my own bit. And I would have my own quotes from actors. So why not? And I've got those stuck away in my files somewhere. But that was a cool thing to, you know, it wasn't an ongoing thing daily.
Well, that's cool because, like, my magazine in Tokyo that I run is a general interest magazine. It's about, you know, life in the city and other types of entertainment, meaning mainstream music and movies and all. It's not a science fiction magazine, but I do sneak in Star Trek related articles.
It cycles around.
Star Wars, in the case of our latest issue, from time to time. So that's cool that you were able to do that even back then.
Yeah, it was it was just kind of in the mix, and it was in the big hubbub of what we all did. And I don't think anybody went like, you know, oh, Larry, you got to write a. It was like, well, I should. I'll just do this. It's, you know, you were just part of a big machine, and you did your little bit. And but it was fond. It was now I look back and I realize that was the year that I interviewed Mark Leonard and talked to Dee. And I actually started seeing them. And I it was also interesting because the press conference that Leonard didn't come to and Dee and Nichelle did. And it was just interesting because I was in the room and it was like a day ahead of the con and all the little local. Wow. I can't remember if it was St. Louis or Kansas City. I'll say St. Louis. But all the local TV stations sent their little pretty boy report, you know, junior reporters out with a camera crew. There's a cameraman and a reporter. And there were a few print people. And there were some fans who had kind of, there were like two or three little fan club people in the back. And then there was no one in charge. No one was running the event. And I didn't realize this until these little microseconds kind of unfolded in my brain. I'm standing there waiting for something to happen. And here we are at the time. And I look over and Dee walks in first and he has shades on, just his plain chambray shirt and a jacket. And, you know, he's the age he is in The Voyage Home. And he kind of ambles in and he's been around the block with this a few times, but there's no one in charge from the convention, no one to escort him, no one to introduce him or call out or start the meeting or start the press conference. And he walks in, he's kind of standing around and I can tell he's kind of like, well, this is pretty laid back. I mean, I can just tell that going through his head. I'm standing there like the observer that's watching all of this. And finally, about a few seconds went by and just because no one else was doing anything, I said, it's dead, Dee. And then he said, it's dead, Jim, just kind of on autopilot. And when he said that, everybody kind of like whipped around like, oh, there's someone in the room. Oh, I wonder if that's somebody we're supposed to pay attention to. Oh, I wonder if that's somebody from the movie. And then like a couple of the fan people in the back, little kids kind of got excited with their little fan club, you know, newsletter pads. And somebody kind of went, oh. And then he sat down and they started, and the TV people were asking like stupidly dumb, dumb, you know, idiot questions, boring, blasé, and the writing people. And every once in a while, and I was mainly taking pictures, and every once in a while I would... not pepper, but I would ask, I was a real reporter, so I just wasn't representing anything from that area. Somebody had said, yes, Larry Nemechek, Norman transcript. Wait, what? And I asked something and he kind of went, ah, ha, ha, like they were still playing this game about being coy with all the plot points, you know, even though so much of it was out. And then a few minutes later, Nichelle came in the room and by then, you know, the thing was broken and she came in and people went, oh, that must be Nichelle Nichols. And they went, and I did the same thing with her a little bit. I was over here and I just asked a question and she was like, oh, she thought I was being sneaky because I was changing sides of the room, you know, like from the left to the right. I'm like, no, I'm just taking the,
Sneaky, she did
one of these ah, ha, ha's at me. And I'm like, I'm just taking pictures from different angles. Which I still have. But no, that was a fun bit. But it was like that was the first time that I kind of started turning the corner from just being a consuming fan or even like a fan that prided myself on staying up on everything to starting to have that, not to put it in a brass plaque in a frame, but to kind of have that professional feeling a little bit.
Well, so when the next film that we're going to talk about, Your First Contact, came out, you very much were reporting on Star Trek all the time. So how was that experience different for you?
Well, that was night and day. We'd moved to the companion sold for Next Generation in 92 and was out the blue cover. And then in 94, we had the red cover and no one was talking. We were in LA and Janet was working on Voyager and no one was talking about what shape the companion would take next. We were kind of waiting to see how things would play out. But I had already decided that why I had relationships with so many people, you know, around the lot, and Janet was there around the stages in the offices, that I kept up my archival interviews, and that's what, you know, On Speaker is now, if they don't dissolve on the cassette reels. But First Contact is Generations was its thing, and First Contact was a lot like Star Trek IV. It was people were so thrilled with it. There was so much internal good feeling buzz, and it was almost like I don't want to say it was an effortless movie, but it was like Jonathan's first film, and he did so well, and everything just there were little, you know, glitchy things, but it just people were just busting at the gut to get it out, and it just had that good feeling, and everyone was excited about it, and you know, Ron and Brandon felt like they had a much better time this time around than all the stuff, the laundry list they had to cram into Generations, and all the things it had to do, and
Well, it was also happening at a time where there was so much other stuff happening for Star Trek as well. Like with Star Trek IV, they were getting ready for the Next Generation launch, and there was all this excitement mm-hmm. around that. And then with First Contact, that was really at the high point, right? Where you've got DS9, you've got Voyager. First Contact was such a success.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that was probably the foam, the 94 to 96, I'd say, when Next Gen was kind of doing its victory lap before we got into the troubled insurrection and Nemesis times, right. And before the ratings numbers kind of started to fall off for, you know, because they'd split the fan base. But, you know, at the time, Paramount was just, I don't want to say milking the cow, but they were milking the cow. And even Rick was saying, hey, we shouldn't do it this much.
We call it milking the targ here on Trek FM.
Oh, that's what we call it. Okay. That's milk. Yeah. But at the time, it was exciting because Janet did a lot of work as an assistant script coordinator on the movie, and she got a credit. You know, they didn't get – that was in those days when all those people didn't get credits on the shows, like on network shows.
And, of course, for those listening who don't know, Janet is your wife.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I should say that, yeah. So she got to do her daytime job on Voyager for First Contact because Bob Gillen was gone a lot. And she would still – since Voyager would be the show that was sitting there till 8 and 9 and 10 doing rewrites and not DS9 because Ira and Ron would send everybody home on their normal time, she would be sitting in the office when they would need crazy rewrites done on pages and read – not rewrites, but, you know, get the new pages out and tracking and all that. So she did so much work that Rick gave her a credit for First Contact. So that was her only one. So we were at the, you know, especially the crew screenings and it was just, it was exciting. I remember the crew screening. I remember a whole bunch of the little people from the offices and everything went out and we went over to, we went nightclubbing that night after the thing. People wanted to go buy Pink's hot dogs for some reason, even though we weren't tourists, and then went to a couple of night spots after that. But people were just, it was just a really heady, exciting time to be part of. It was like Star Trek could do no wrong, and the numbers were just going up and up and up, and we knew it was going to be a huge hit, and all the gears were clicking, and, you know, it was just a great time to be there. And
and you had access to people to interview in a way that you didn't with Star Trek IV.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I didn't, you know, we had a regular publicist, and we were doing, and I was doing writing for the Titan magazine, and this was 2 years before I did the Communicator, but I was already doing writing for the UK magazine when it was just a UK magazine every 2 months. But I was, so I had that and several things for an umbrella, but basically it was everybody from the shows was working on the movie. So it was very easy just to sit down and talk to everybody about that and have that back so that finally when the plan was, okay, the last Next Gen movie, this is where we'll end the companion editions. I didn't have to scramble around since I had another grand, you know, 3 months to do that in. I didn't have to scramble around and get things from people four years later, 6 years later, whatever. Mm-hmm. I had all the fresh stuff from in the day, just that pile of, you know, hours and hours of things. So it was easy to do. But so, yeah, so I had done my homework and got all that on tape, even though I was only using a fraction of it in the day.
Yeah.
But, And excellent, because Pocket wasn't, it's like they missed the boat on this and didn't do a book, but Titan did in the UK, and it was a very cool thing, and I wrote probably about a third of it, even though my name wasn't the byline. There were three, Ian Spelling and I wrote like a third, and I think mine was actually more than a third. Ian Spelling did all the actor interviews, and I did about two-thirds of the rest of it, the nonfiction back behind the scenes. And that was amazing. And then Pocketbook says, oh, we should have done a book. And so they made a big hoo-ha about having Terry do a book for Insurrection, which didn't sell as many copies. Imagine that. But no, it was just a great time. Great time.
Yeah, but that chapter on how Worf got on the Enterprise was gold, and that was a fantastic chapter.
You're just not going to leave. Somehow I don't feel like I've heard the end of that one tonight.
Yeah, and the great thing about both of these movies, too, is that they're two of the best Star Trek movies in the opinions of the majority of the fan base sees First Contact as the best, if not one of the two best TNG movies, and then Star Trek IV, I think, is definitely in the top three for most fans in terms of their favorite TOS films.
Right. There were so many great mini set pieces in Star Trek. There were in First Contact, too, but they're different. You know, they're serving different masters. What was interesting also about First Contact was I have, like, the whole script evolutionary process was, there were a couple of major flip-flops along the way, and but just to have had that detailed a record of how the process went. Well, the filming too, and it was a good shoot pretty much from front to back. But I have pictures, thanks to the set photographer. I have pictures of me. I was watching them film. It wasn't an official press publicist day, but I forget what happened, how this happened, but they were shooting the deflector scenes, the deflector dish scenes. And I don't think it was a day when they almost, when like Patrick and Michael almost suffocated in those suits the first time they tried to use them. But the set photographer was really gracious and said he was looking at things like, hey, you know, if you give me a credit, I'll take the picture for your book, like the author, about the author picture. And so I took these pictures in front of the deflector dish, you know, the guts that the mm-hmm. Borg were Borgifying, which were actually bird feeders modified, these clear cylinders with points on the ends. But there's
not
pictures.
Borg
I've got
feeders,
pictures.
But bird
yes.
feeders.
Yes. Yes. Borg feeders. I've got pictures of me just posed up against them for the about the author photo that was never used that way. But anyway, good memories.
That's cool. Well, it's hard to believe it's been 29 years for The Voyage Home and 19 years for First Contact, but time keeps marching on. And one more thing you were telling me about before we started recording on the other side of the room, fast forwarding in production time to Enterprise, is Vince Diedrich, who was a stunt coordinator on Enterprise, had his director's chair stolen, as I understand it. Now he's looking for it. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is just a little goofy thing that just came to me this week. Vince got a hold of me, and he's a really good guy. His dad was the stuntman on the original series, and a million other, you know, shows at the time. Vince's dad was, I think, Matthews, but the guy that Ruck pushes off the precipice in What Are Little Girls Made Of? That was his dad.
Okay.
As a red shirt. His dad was an official dead red shirt. But Vince was the stunt coordinator when they made some changes in staffing going into Enterprise to have that fresh break, fresh start. And he was a great guy and very nice to be around, always really nice to me. But he was telling me, he got a hold of me this week. I hadn't talked to him in a long time. He was at Vegas 2 or 3 years ago with his dad. But apparently, I never known this until just now, but apparently one of the crew gifts, second season, I think, was everybody got a gift chair, a director's chair with, you know, and then the panels that come, the cloth panels that slip over the wooden frame. You put your name on it, and, you know, Enterprise, whatever. But for some reason, oddly, and not as part of a big mass theft, his chair disappeared off the stages in sometime in the third season. You know, not Scott's, not Jolene's, but his for some reason. And anyway, he called me this week and told me about this because he had come across recently seeing it online available, valued and auctioned at some point in 2011, like a website that was still up and fresh, at a place in the UK. But basically, he got it that whoever had it out, had sold it, and that it's probably even gone through 3 or 4 owners. So basically, he was calling me to see, and we're going to do this, get the word out, social media, and hey, why not start here with the Ready Room, that if anybody has any information about Vince Diedrich's Enterprise director's chair, you know, the cross-legged wooden stool, chair, folding chair with the cloth panels that fit over the back to personalize it, to get in touch with me. And I'll get back to Vince. He understands that it's gone through 3 or 4 owners. The person that has it now, out there hopefully somewhere, has no clue that it was ever even stolen. He just wants to buy it back. He just wants to work out a deal and buy his chair back. You know, it's been 10 years. That was, what, 2003-ish, 4-ish? Mm-hmm. So he was just thinking it would be nice to have. And I think he really got, his interest really got piqued when he was going through, you know, somehow Googling online and came across his old stolen chair
right
at an auction from 2011. So I totally understand how he feels. So anyway, I'm just going to throw some things out through all my channels and see if we can't get, especially if it's still in the UK somehow, but it could be anywhere by now. Let's get fandom onto this and you know, get on the hunt and see if we can find Vince's chair and get he and the current owner hooked up so they can make a deal and he can get it back.
Interesting story. Yeah, I'm sure he was really surprised to come across that because it's not exactly the kind of thing that you would expect to find. Maybe if it was Brendan Braga's chair, then yeah, find that at an auction.
Yeah,
but yeah.
When I was in grad school at the University of Kansas in our theater building, I took my high school class ring off to wash my hands because I was grimy working in the prop shop. And I was about halfway back down the hall when I realized I didn't get my ring back. And by the time I'd just gone 20 yards back to the restrooms, you know, big group restrooms, it was gone. I'm like, wow. Okay, yep. I can't believe it, you know, that fast, and it's gone. And fast forward to about 6 years ago, maybe, and I get this letter from somebody in Iowa that says they had just bought a dresser at a flea market, and they found this class ring in one of the empty drawers. And now, that's the story, and I don't care.
Yeah.
But they got in touch with me, and they said, I said, how did you find me? And they said, well, we could see it's got an Oklahoma on it, and it says Noble, and we had these initials on the inside, and we called Noble High School and asked them if there was somebody with these initials from this year. And so they found me, and, you know, social media helped that. So I
That's amazing.
I know, I was like, wow, okay.
Well, see, I'm in the same boat. I also lost my class ring from the University of Alabama when I was a senior in a bathroom. Yeah, you know, I took it off at the sink and left, and I never got it back. So similar experience, except no one found mine in a dresser. So,
well, maybe there's some flea market out there that'll turn up someday. Yeah,
yeah. All right. Well, Larry, speaking of chairs, let's pull up a chair for a longtime friend of the show who hasn't dropped by for quite a while. And that would, of course, be Terrace Cassidy from Geek Nation Tours. Terrace, thanks for coming back.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
So, Terrace, we've asked you to join us today for a new story here because we know you have some exciting things going on with Geek Nation Tours. And Larry was telling me a bit about it. So, Larry, why don't you take it from here?
It's really exciting because Geek Nation Tours, as I'm sure all the listeners know, you've just been exploding with all kinds of things, not just this Trek tour, but all kinds of military and historical and other nerd geek passions. But here in the Trek realm, Our 50th anniversary, LA to Vegas, our film site tour is bigger than ever next year. We've already talked about it, and it's exploding. We've had more people come aboard, and then also, yeah. But then I want you to talk about this Geek Elite tour.
Oh, okay, sure. Yeah. Well, as you know that, our Star Trek tour is doing really well, and one of those guests that we have talking with us there is Rod Roddenberry, and we're happened to partner with him and Roddenberry Adventures for a special type of event that we're going to do, a nerd tour, a geek tour, a science exploration tour. It'll be to various places all across the United States talking about space exploration. So every Star Trek fan will really love it, I'm sure. We started off in L.A. and head off to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And, of course, we'll have some guests, speakers all the way through. Again, Rod will be joining us for that.
Yeah, and just to clarify, we're talking about this whole new huge mega tour. Not our we can talk about our Star Trek one in a minute, our film site tour. But you're talking about what's the name of this?
This is our Touching the Stars tour.
Yeah, that's what I want to make sure we're clear about it. Yeah,
it's really about everything space exploration, what we're doing now and what we're headed into the future. We hope to have some private companies come talk to us. We'll go to Houston and do the ascent there, see a whole bunch of astronauts and get them to join us for lunch and talk about their adventures. And, of course, Kennedy Space Center, of course, also will be headed that way, too. So lots of seminars and just a great tour about looking at our vision of traveling into space. And a little bit closer to home, time-wise. We don't have any warp capacity yet, but hopefully we'll get there. It's actually one of our Geek Elite packages. We're going into a new kind of phase with Geek Nation Tours, and Geek Elite is one of our subcategories for our tours. It'll be a huge tour, again, crossing right across the United States, and we have something very special in mind for this also. We'll be doing a space zero-G experience. So we'll be headed off with Zero-G Corporation and doing the parabolic flight so you experience weightlessness.
Otherwise known as the...
the nice plane.
The VC, the Vomit Comet. Okay, I didn't say
that's
that.
Right.
You'll be fine. But the big thing, just to make sure and clarify this is a huge scope tour. This is like you're going to basically our space centers in America, right? Pasadena, Houston, and then the Cape area in Florida.
That's right.
Right. And it's touring plus panel talk seminar thing. It's a whole realm of experiences, right?
That's exactly it. Yeah. And we've got tons, like I said, we've got tons of speakers. And also what's really great about it is we have the private industry also. We've got, of course, NASA very much involved, and we're hoping to have some private companies come by and talk to us about what they do. Mum's kind of the word right now on which ones those are, but if you type in Los Angeles and find a company, an aerospace company, you might find the right one. So.
But also, and we're here on the Ready Room, there's a lot, you know, since so much of it's a little bit like my nonprofit that I work with, Enterprise in Space, there is so much science fiction and Star Trek overlapping the real world space program that a lot of the people on both sides of the fence have the same interests back and forth. I always talk about the mutual love affair between NASA and Star Trek, but up and down the positive nuts and bolts end of science fiction, or the people that were in or future, just general futurism, right? I mean, there's kind of an overlapping pool, and some of the guests you're going to have, you're planning on having, that you've already talked to me about even, are going to reflect that, right?
Yeah, well, I really want to make sure that we have a utopian vision of the future, how to move forward. We'll talk about not only how we're moving forward, but how to move forward as a species, and our first attempts to get out there and look around. I think it's really important for us to make sure that we step in the right direction. And I'm going to really make it so this is it will have a Star Trek flavor for sure. Roddenberry vision of that we can do it right, and we can do it. We can do include everyone on the planet and head up. So. Head up into the dark blue yonder, or black yonder, I guess. But yeah, we really want to explore that frontier vision, and really want to make sure that we have something that has a positive outlook on space exploration. And that's really what our goals are, is to create a tour that makes you smile when you look up into space after that, and say, I was touching there. I was talking to the people that really make it possible, and talk to people at JPL that send robots up and are exploring space every day, you know. And I think that's we've kind of lost that. We don't have as many astronauts landing on planets or moons as we used to, but we're still exploring. I mean, that's one thing that I think we kind of forget. We take for granted all our robots up in space, and that's what I want to say is that with this tour is to say, listen, we're still going, and we're still building, and we're still moving on, and we're on and upward.
Yeah. And the date for this tour is, he said, knowing the answer.
It's going to be in 2017. We're still going back and forth. Of course, next year is 2016. Very busy year for Roddenberry, and very busy year for us, actually, of course, because not only do Rod has his varying tours that he's going on to, but we also have our big Star Trek tour and several others. The Star Trek tour will be our crown next year, though, because it's going to be a stellar tour in itself. Yeah. So anyway, so the whole point of it is it'll probably be in 2017 now. We are hoping late 2016, but it looks like it's going to be.
But didn't you tell me it was, and by the way, I want to thank you for having me. I mean, this is a much bigger, we're going to have the biggest scope ever for our Star Trek tour next year with Larry Demichek. But this, what you're talking about with touching the stars is even bigger. So I just thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, you're going to be part of it too, of course.
Yep.
You'll come and talk to us at Tillman, of course. We're going to go to Tillman, and that's where we're going to have, I think, the focus of that day will be utopian futures. And Rod will talk about his father's legacy and how he saw the past and the future. And we'll have a couple other speakers, and Larry's going to be one of them. So
Tillman Water Plant, a.k.a. the main backdrop as Starfleet Academy.
That's right.
That we know as Starfleet Academy headquarters.
Yeah, we'll have a lunch out there, and I think that it'll really have a great flavor, and it'll definitely, you know, let us know or keep us dreaming of what we have in store for ourselves out there in the depths of space.
Yeah.
So I really want to make sure it has a positive vision, and that's where we're going. And you know, We're still out there. We're still headed out there. People take that for granted.
Well, and speaking of still headed out, just real quickly, the LA to Vegas Star Trek tour that we're doing next year, just to kind of back up a little bit and do something more familiar to folks. But we've got like already 50% more people than we've ever had go before signed up, right? It's going to be just amazing. I mean, I'm all
that's
excited.
That's the slogan of the tour, now with 50% more people.
That's right.
Which is better than the slogan for the other one we've been talking about, which is, if you've ever wanted to touch Larry Nemechek.
Oh, that's it. Is that part of the tour now, Larry? I didn't know that. That's great.
Who's been talking about this? Who's this we?
That's awesome. Yeah, well, I'm very excited about that tour also. I'm, as you know, I'm a big Star Trek fan, so excited that it's going to be the 50th. Know that the hotel is already filling up in Vegas, and
I just saw the Rio has sold out, and the Rio is taking steps to align with a few other hotels. I guess the Gold Coast and a couple of them there nearby. If people aren't doing it on their own, yeah, I just saw that. I mean, that was a crazy wild rumor in August, September, but now it's November, and they are saying I saw where the Rio is reaching out to get rooms at other, and people are doing it on their own. So if you're in the tour, we've got a room block, right?
That's right. Yeah, we sure do. And
for the Rio, so
we're still laughing that way. So,
but what's exciting is the San Fran. I mean, if you missed the earlier, I think a few months ago we first put this together. We were talking about how we're going to have an optional standalone or add it to or whatever a San Francisco component, which I've been looking forward to for ages, where we can go to the real places and the fictional places of Star Trek, and everybody. Headquarters and the Golden Gate Bridge, but also the Sanctuary District from the Bell Riots and everything from Star Trek IV for real life, and including the aquarium. And
Well, this is actually my first time to San Francisco, so I'm very excited about the possibility and very excited that you're going to be leading us all around.
Yeah, I did some research last year from what I hadn't gone through yet, so we were retracing the Star Trek IV steps. But no, it's just going to be awesome. And there's so many little, I think people don't realize some of the little, obscure places from, if they weren't
really
an
like
actual filming site. Yeah, the fictional places too from San Francisco, that as much as we can put in. So, and then even the LA tour, we've kept some of the really popular things, and we've swapped out some others. So we have Rod and Chase joining us at different times, maybe some more people, but we're going to some different places too. So I just really am excited. But just to let people know, we talk about we've got 50% more people going. We still have plenty of slots to go.
There's still a few spots left. It is going fast, though. I mean, it comes in groups. All of a sudden, I've got a couple emails, and bang, we're a few more people booked. So. Yeah, it is going well. So if you want to hop aboard that one, definitely come aboard and keep your eyes to our page about our Geek Elite and join us on something that's going to be stellar.
So Terrace, what is the URL if people want to go and find out all the details of both of these tours?
Sure, you can go to geeknationtours.com or you can contact me directly at headgeek@geeknationtours.com.
Awesome. Head Geek, the big giant head geek.
That's right. That's me.
Get that geek to sick bay. Okay.
I was picturing William Shatner on Third Rock from the Sun as the big giant head, except it's Terrace instead of William Shatner.
Oh, and I didn't mention, but we have the one-day tour out to Valley. Speaking of William Shatner, we have the one-day tour out to Valley of Fire tour for people that want to just jump in for a day and get a taste right before the con starts in Vegas in August too. But yeah, I knew that the Touching the Stars was moving along and people should know about that. It's a couple of ways down and it's an even bigger extravaganza, but it's just exciting to be part of.
It is. I was very happy to build it. It's part of my past too. I was in honors physics in my first year in university, actually wanting to be a astrophysicist myself. That didn't work out, but now I get to plan tours to like places. So,
yeah,
awesome. Sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. And I don't know if I'll get to join you. I'm always stuck over here in Japan, but hopefully many people listening will. So thanks, Terrace, for filling us in on it today.
Thank you.
Good to talk, Terrace. I'll talk to you soon.
Well, before we wrap up news here, Larry, there are a couple of holiday things that I want to remind everything about. One of them is for us here at the network, but I understand you've also got a special for people that's still going to be available for a little while after this show drops for Portal 47, I think.
you know, it's a nice gift, stocking stuffer even, because it's the CD shell that I will sell, but that I will autograph for anybody. But I've got volume four, and I also have volume twos and threes, and we have a multiple price for my Trekland on speaker, which are the archived, remastered archival interviews. Some of the stuff we've been talking about here already, especially with First Contact, there's material, that kind of material on there, although they're about the next-gen DS9 finales, and then the new one this year was about Voyager's premiere. And I know we've got a Voyager episode coming up, so maybe we've got that'll pique somebody's interest. But aside from that, this year we have, you know, memberships to Portal 47 as a gift thing. And so the whole point is this month, if you jump into Portal 47, which for the price of a movie ticket for two every month, we do all of our deep dives, our backstage passes to the 24th century using the best of the 21st. But we've had some great guests on our telebriefings, and people get a chance to just talk to me once a month. And we have our telebriefings, and we have archival things coming out of my archives, audio and pictures and all that. And some deals, even if you've been on the Trekland trunk, there's a break for you. There's basically a package of 10 things, and there's even some live events for the big conventions and when I may be in your neck of the woods for anybody out there. We're even going to the UK next spring, which will be exciting. So for the whole Portal 47 package, that's a great gift, either for yourself or for somebody else. And if you do get it as a gift and let me know, I'll send a card along with it and memorialize that. But the thing is, I decided to do a Cyber Monday special. And we just passed Cyber Monday, so I'm extending it. But if anybody jumps in and gets a Portal 47 pass, I will throw in a bonus 13th month for free. But also, I have some limited numbers of Voyager DS9 and Enterprise call sheets extras. So jump in and do that. And you know, by Cyber Monday's extension through December 7th, let me know, and I will send you also an actual physical, real Voyager Enterprise or DS9 call sheet, your choice.
Awesome. So December 7th is the deadline for yes. taking advantage of the special.
All right. And I hope everybody does. And, of course, I also like to throw out Enterprise in Space has a great $20 simple gift option there you can do to help support that nonprofit project. And if you're really wanting to make an impression on your giftee, there's Geek Nation tours and our tours next year during the 2016 50th anniversary show.
Awesome. So a lot of great stuff right there. And then for the other thing about the network, some of you know from listening or yes. following us in the Babel Conference or on Twitter, we finally opened a store for Trekkafilm merchandise, and that makes a great holiday gift as well. So if you're looking for shirts or mugs or stickers or even notebooks or phone cases, we have a wide variety of products. And we have great artwork by our mm-hmm. art director, Aaron Harvey. Of course, we have our logo. We have a really cool word cloud with catchphrases from the shows and show names and all that's in the shape of the Enterprise.
I love
Plus
that one. Yeah.
Things like Team Lizard Babies, which is the To the Journey team on the Bridge Mates game on Earl Grey, as well as the other teams, the Maroon Monsters and Free Enterprise. And we also have Ninja Cat, and we have our ode to Pulaski's conquests. You know, she hooked up with Riker's dad. So you can find all of that stuff in our store. And our store is part of Redbubble. They do sales fairly often. So if you keep your eye out for Redbubble, and in fact, if you sign up for their newsletter, you'll get this stuff. And they sometimes give coupons as well. But they do sales of like 20% off from time to time. So that's a great way to save some money as well. And I'm sure they'll do some heading into the holidays. They just did some on Black Friday, which we promoted through our Facebook groups and such. So anyway, go check that out. You can get there by going to trek.fm/store. And you can click through from there. Or you can go to trekfm.link/trekfmstore. And that'll take you there as well. Or just go to Redbubble and type Trek FM into the search field and you'll find that there. So a lot of great gifts between us and what Larry has.
Does Redbubble, do they still have that stuff that you can like jump through vortexes and blow up Romulus? And
yes, they do. Yes.
Fly jellyfish around. And
The thing is, you only need one very, very small Redbubble in order to destroy Romulus. That's right.
Okay. Well, I believe in not being a pig, you know, and not wasting it.
All right. So go check out those if you're looking for great Trek gifts, either for yourself or for your friends and family. Now, before we jump into the feature, I want to remind everyone that The Ready Room is just one of many, many shows we have here on the network. So here's a quick look at some other things that we've been discussing on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
They just happen to come at just the right time.
Right,
or
just the right time for it to be dangerous.
Like, literally, like, not even, like, that day, but, like 2 minutes before this happens.
Earl Grey.
Well, it does all those cloak experiments. It deployed that communications array.
Minefield?
And the minefield for exploratory purposes.
Let's not talk about the Defiant, because you know it's just going to upset me.
To the journey!
What about Tommy?
Tommy is a drunk, and...
He's drunk in the ready room meeting. His head's down, and so Janeway says, Tom, anything?
Just not so loud! Commentary, Trek Stars.
You know what? See, the thing is now, if Star Trek Beyond goes sideways in any way, you've planted that line in my brain. I'm like, I only got half a peg, and I'm just going to trot that out. If I don't like Star Trek Beyond.
The 602 Club.
I remember hearing Timothy Zahn, even back then, reading an article that he was listening to the John Williams scores in his car as he was thinking all this through and making sure the pacing felt like it did with the music. So maybe it had to do with the certain music he was listening to. Maybe he was listening to a New Hope score at that point. I don't know.
Literary Treks.
I think we had between the three of us half a dozen or eight different springboards, and they were written in such a way that they could have gone to either ship and crew. It was like, you know, the Sagittarius encounters big blob in space, or Endeavor encounters derelict spacecraft, or I'm being real surface here. I mean, the prompts we provided in the Bible were probably just a couple of sentences long, and it was just meant to say these are the kinds of stories we're thinking about.
Women at Warp.
So we went in and pitched, and I have to say that was one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. I have scrubbed in on brain surgery. It did not frighten me as much as waiting outside Gene Roddenberry's office getting ready to go in and pitch to him.
Meta Trex.
You're not going to see a bunch of Klingons hanging around eating cake and you know, laughing at
well, unless it's a peptide cake with mint frosting.
Peptide cake, indeed.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find these everywhere you get your podcasts. Of course, we're in iTunes at itunes.com/trekfm. We're on Stitcher. We're on TuneIn, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. You can go to the website and stream from the show page or download the MP3 files. We try to make it really easy for you to get our shows wherever you listen to audio. So just search for Trek.fm or the name of your favorite show, and it should come right on up. And we hope you enjoy it all. All right, so Larry, let's bring in Char and Brandon so we can talk about Voyager.
I can't wait.
Voyager is known for teching the tech and telling stories that rely heavily on scientific jargon and technical jargon, and they really outdid themselves in the second season episode, Deadlock, but they did it in, I think, a really fine way. Voyager is duplicated, and one Voyager is unknowingly destroying the other. So two Janeways have to put their heads together, find a solution, and along the way, help Harry Kim, who has once again been killed. And today we're going to talk about this episode. And to help us do that, we are joined by executive producer here on the network, Mistress Charlene Schmidt. Hey, Char.
Hello, hello. Glad to be back for yet another Ready Room.
Yes, and a Voyager
one. I've been on a lot lately.
You have been.
But it's always fun, and especially when it's time to do Voyager.
Well, I think you're one of the most popular people on the network, Char.
For the first time in my life, I'm popular. I'll take it.
Also joining us for the first time here on The Ready Room is associate producer from Literary Treks, Brandon Shea Mutala. Brandon, welcome.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. Glad to have you here with us. And in fact, you chose the episode today.
I did. This is my personal favorite episode of Star Trek Voyager. Number one on my list, for sure.
It's a good choice.
Larry, you were a little surprised by that, weren't you?
Oh, well, no, I mean, I don't mean like you dip fod. What is that? I just am curious. Anytime anybody comes out and says something is their very favorite, I'm always curious to know, you know, what it is.
Except for that time someone told you that Prophet and Lace was their favorite episode of DS9, and then you spit your drink out and were really left speechless.
You told me you edited that out, Chris.
He lied to you.
All right. Well, before we get into the discussion, let's do a synopsis, as we always do, for those who have not seen this episode. Samantha Wildman is finally ready to give birth, and in a very kind gesture, Janeway decides to stop the ship while the doctor performs the delivery, because you don't want to rock the ship around or anything. But then they realize that there are some Vidian planets and a bunch of Vidian ships up ahead, and so Janeway decides, well, we better get going and fly into it. You know how she likes to fly into danger. Well, somehow along the way, Voyager gets duplicated as they pass through some kind of duplication field. And one Voyager is trying to solve its problems with its warp engines, they're losing antimatter, by initiating proton bursts. And it turns out that this is destroying the duplicate Voyager. Now, along the way, we have to figure out which Voyager is which. It gets a little bit confusing, but it's a very interesting story. In the end, two Janeways have to put their heads together to find a solution. Harry Kim dies, and I don't even know what happens to Neelix. So...
He chokes on a Leola root in the kitchen.
I was just thinking something we were talking about on the other side of the room that made me think of Neelix. But anyway, in the end, they find a solution, and we're back to one Voyager, and life goes on. But getting there is not easy, and we're going to talk about the solution here today. So that's the basic synopsis. How was that, Char? Was that a good synopsis? I think it was a pretty bad one.
That's way better than I would have done.
Was it? Yeah. Okay.
Bravo.
Well, I don't know. But anyway, let's talk about our initial thoughts here. So, Brandon, I'm going to ask you to go first, since this is your favorite episode of Voyager. What are your initial thoughts on Deadlock?
So the first thing that really grabs me about this episode is the teaser. And the greatest
it's
thing about
really
this...
really long. It's like 7.5 minutes long.
I'll chime in on that later, but go ahead.
Yeah, it is longer than 3 frames. Voyager has some extremely short teasers most of the time. So I think that's great. But not only that, the teaser itself has every single main character in it. So right off the bat, you're getting a lot of everybody. And I think that's something that's different about this show as well, because a lot of Voyager episodes, like, you might not even see a character for the whole episode because it's just focusing on one or two different people and then a few side characters here and there. But even in the teaser of this, you get something from everybody. And that's what I really, really like about it.
That's a good point.
Yeah. How about you, Char?
Yeah, I like this episode. It is not my absolute favorite, but it's definitely one of the strong standouts of season 2, especially. I don't know what's not to love in this. It's a really good science fiction story. It's a lot of fun. You get two Janeways arguing with one another. You have a disheveled Bun of Steel as opposed to the clean Bun of Steel. and of course, you mentioned that Harry dies, but he doesn't. And I have a theory about that I want to mention a little later on when we discuss that in detail, but it's always something that whenever I do a rewatch, I always watch this episode. I never skip it, ever.
Well, I agree with you guys. I'm going to give my quick initial thoughts here and then pass it over to Larry, because I know he's going to have some really interesting stuff to throw in there.
That's a high bar. Okay.
I really enjoyed this episode as well. You know, they wanted to do like a high concept sci-fi story here, and I think they pulled it off pretty well. I'm on record here over many years of doing The Ready Room as feeling that Voyager leans too heavily on technobabble to tell their stories. And there's a lot of that in here. And I'm not going to pretend to actually understand what's going on all the time, certainly not on a first watch. it gets kind of confusing from time to time, but I think it's a really fun story. I love alternate reality stories. I love parallel universe stories. And the idea that there could be these two ships sharing the same space is really cool. And for that reason, I think it's a fun story. There are some flaws with it, which I'll probably talk about along the way.
Flaws.
But I definitely enjoy it. So, Larry, how about you? Initial thoughts or interesting thoughts or whatever you want to throw out here?
Well, it's always funny going back and rewatching some of the later shows that I didn't do a book over or that I was here to watch them be done. Well, so Deadlock, number one for me, was an interesting show. It was like, oh, this was where they did the doubles and the baby got born. I mean, that's kind of how... and the fun fact is, you know, Kim and Naomi were always fakes from here onward on the real Voyager.
He's a fake.
He's a fake. talk about crossing streams.
Hold up a Harry Kim action figure while you do that.
There you go.
You know what? Somehow I have managed to spin around this world all these years, and I do not have a Harry Kim action figure. Now, how in the world I've survived?
And you call yourself Dr. Trek.
I have plush. Yeah. I have 15 McCoys up here, but I don't have a...
Well, of course.
No, I mean, so Deadlock is just like, okay, one of those... It's just an early Voyager second season-y one where they're getting their legs, and Brannon is having more and more input over the writing. And I was just refreshing some things. I mean, my historic things, I think, okay, that was the one where they doubled, and they doubled and they cooked up a thing, and it was dramatic, and it was kind of interesting what they did with the, you know, they actually killed people and then brought their doppelgangers in, and the whole bit with the rift through the exploded Jeffries tube was really kind of ambitious at the time, I think. And was kind of an amazing image to watch happen. But the main thing that I think of over the years is, this is the script in all of televised Star Trek. I mean, any era, any show. This is the show that was the epitome of the Michael came back and Jerry Michael and Brannon, who wasn't even a co-executive or a co-executive producer, but was kind of going into that role, they would get into these writing wars, change wars. And this is back when Janet was the assistant script coordinator and got stuck with doing all the changes. But to me, on top of everything else, Deadlock is the script that is infamous for having gone through the color change wheel more times than any other single televised Star Trek script, original series onward.
For those listening, Larry is holding the script up on camera right now.
It went through the, there's like 10 colors. You know, people are familiar with color change pages, and they're done that way so everybody can keep them straight, and they're issued, and people stick them in their scripts, and now that it's digital, it comes as PDFs, and you can do whatever you want to do with that. But it's, you know, it's blue, pink, yellow, green, gold, green tint, buff. Can I remember all of them? SN. What's SN? Sienna? No. CY is cherry. CY is cherry, and then tan, and then it restarts to white. And that's like 10 colors in the cycle. Deadlock went through the color wheel 21 times.
Oh my gosh.
So David Livingston was the director for this. And, you know, late night Livingston, he would be there for late. And since he was a producer, line producer and producer, he could get away with stuff that some of the other directors couldn't. But he just decided that this show had to be like hell of fire and directed the hell out of it. And the whole thing does move very fast as to pace. And it moves so fast that they wound up, the script is, I mean, part of the, not all those changes, but the last three or four were because this sucker is like, well, it says 64 pages, but there's a bunch of A pages in there. They wound up like 3 or 4 minutes short. And at the end, they were like madly rewriting, they were adding whole scenes they could do fast and quick, like with two characters. And your beloved long teaser, the actual original teaser started on the bridge, just the normal, oh, here we are on the bridge reading our scanners thing. And all of the scenes of Neelix and Wildman in the mess hall, in fact, it got like linked, like write some and they'd shoot it and it would still be short and they would go back and like add to the new scenes they already shot.
Oh wow!
I mean,
crazy.
The teaser started with the bridge. Then they wrote a scene where Naomi is. I mean, I say Naomi, Ensign Wildman, Samantha, Sam, Ensign Wildman is helping him fix the replicator, And they go, oh, okay. And then that was short. So then they backed it up and started off with she walks in and Neelix says, hi. And, oh, look, oh, could you take a look at this? Okay, I will. Oh. I mean, it's just, it's that. But there's a long scene in Act 3. This is not the teaser. There's a long scene in Act 3 where they're talking about the baby's chances of surviving and making it and all that. There's three, as usual, when they add scenes into a show, it's like some of the best character scenes sometimes, yeah. Which is the irony of TV writing. But anyway, but that's a little fun fact. We can talk about more about that in a little bit.
I think they should always have some footage of Neelix cooking where he's flipping food and flames are coming up and like he's really a chef in the kitchen.
And he's panicked
and they
somehow.
Just have that and they can just splice that into any mm-hmm. episode where they need an extra 30 seconds or 60 seconds.
It's kind of like Sulu at the view screen, this Bob Justman stock footage where he's turning around looking back at Kirk's point of view, you know, yeah. with the view screen to Maddie.
Yeah, yeah.
See, yeah. Neelix cooking all the time. It's just an excuse for Neelix to be drinking.
Of course, you can use that wine for something besides cooking.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's a little Justin Wilson
in there.
There's
right
a reason.
There.
There's a little Justin Wilson for you there, Chris. Chop up that onion. Yeah.
There's a
yeah.
reason why Neelix likes to cook.
There was two more things about this episode that I think are absolutely outstanding and really bring it to my top for me. 12 minutes into the episodes here, you're almost a third way down the show. The baby dies, Kim dies, and Kes disappears all within 60 seconds. When I watch that, and even still, I'm watching this, and as soon as I'm like, you're blown away by a baby dying because you're like, who kills a baby on network TV? And you're blown away by Harry Kim dying. You're like, what's going on here? And then Kes disappears. And every time I watch it, I'm just like, what is going on with this episode? This is bonkers. And that's how I felt the first time I watched it. And I still have the feeling every time I watch it. And then when Tuvok gives his damage report, his damage report goes on and on and on. Like uh-huh. the ship is in bad shape. It's a 45-second damage report.
And the last thing in the damage report is... Oh, and the baby died.
Yeah. That's one thing I like about Deadlock, too, is that, man, you get sucked into this episode. It keeps going from bad to worse. Everything just goes straight to hell. And you wonder, how are they going to get themselves out of this? How are they going to reset button this one? And it actually ends up being a pretty good one.
Like, it's pretty far into the episode before they even go to the other ship, right? The split ship. It's like, it's mm-hmm. like 60 minutes into the episode, mm-hmm. and you're like, what is going on? And then cuts to the other one, and Janeway sees the ghost of herself, and it's like, oh, okay, there's something else yeah. going on here.
Right.
Green screen fever.
Well, according to Brandon Braga, they wanted to tell a story where they're telling one story, and then suddenly they're telling a different story. And then you're left wondering what's going on
right.
because, like you said, it is a while before they go over to the other ship and it is a while before you figure out what's happening. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Talking about damage report, I think Tuvok forgot to mention that 96 of his candles melted in his quarters. He's very concerned about what he's going to do.
He was at Wick's End
that night. And the other thing is Harry Kim dying. I just have a question here. So... If my eyes
don't question
were showing
it, just
me what
it.
Was really on the screen and I wasn't being deceived, a hole is blown in the bulkhead. Harry Kim is halfway or maybe 90% of his body is out in space and he's still holding on and reaching out and trying to get B'Elanna's hand to pull him in.
Yeah, totally plausible.
How does that work? Mm-hmm.
Harry Kim's amazing.
It's the one bit of science that I realize does not actually work in this episode. Most of the time, I don't know if it's actually scientifically accurate, and I don't care that much because I'm being entertained, yeah. and I like where the story is going regardless. But there's that one thing there where, no.
Oh, you guys, it's that crazy Delta Quadrant physics at work. That's what it okay. is. Everything
imagine,
is weird
you know,
in the Delta Quadrant. Yeah.
Well, okay, the apologist in me says, well, there's force fields that are trying to get Harry back into
yeah.
where there's gravity and oxygen, but
well, that's what I
that's
thought,
only...
too, at first. I'm like, okay, well, there's some kind of force field that's extending past him, but at the same time...
extend shields around Harry! Yeah, that's
right.
what it is.
Right!
I'm pretty sure there is a control panel on the bridge with buttons to help Harry in all the situations he finds himself in, right?
Yeah, it's a flow chart. How is Harry dying? Or how is right. Harry's life endangered? And then you've got all the options and you have to proceed from there.
Quick, Tuvok, erect a containment field around Harry.
I just level, gotta Captain? Save Harry and Harry. No, I'm... It's, yeah.
Have you heard Garrett Wong's story about this episode? So I went when I went to Vegas, I got to meet him. He was the first celebrity that I met, and I went up to him, and I'm like, I don't know what to say to you. Hello. And he started talking to me, so I told him this was my favorite episode, and he's like, oh, that's the one where I die. Oh, and then paraphrasing here, he's like, yeah, it's funny, because you watch the episode, and it's like, I'm in the Jeffries tube, and I'm trying to save everything, and I get blown out the side, and B'Elanna calls up to the bridge, and she's like, and Harry Kim's dead. And Janeway's like, okay, but what about the deck?
Yeah. He's right. Yeah. Well, that sucks, but Harry. Well, what else you got, B'Elanna?
Harry Kim, the checkoff of Voyager, yeah.
Another bit of poor Harry guy. Kim, or Garrett Wong's story here about Harry Kim is that, you know, he actually gets to do what I think, and I need to ask you guys, does this qualify as a barrel roll? When he comes in to shoot the Vidians, and it was his idea, and he improvised it on the set. And he gets to, it's more of a forward flip. So I have to ask you, Char, does it qualify as a barrel roll?
When he gets sucked out into space?
No. When he comes into sick bay, he's late
getting
in the episode
shot at. Yeah, he comes in firing.
To get Naomi. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Geordi might disqualify it because he does the real, genuine barrel roll.
Well,
but I think this is just Harry Kim's style of a barrel roll. I want to count it.
I hate to break it to Garrett, but is there an isolation door rolling down at the same time? If not, then it doesn't count.
I agree
is
with Larry.
You know, it's because the Geordi barrel roll is he's barrel rolling under the isolation door coming down.
Yeah, exactly. But is that the case every single time? I mean, that's just the signature barrel roll.
Tom and Harry
I'm being
walking
facetious,
down.
Sure.
Because Kirk does
a
barrel roll.
Do I have to chastise you now?
Kirk does a barrel roll in the animated series. An animated barrel roll.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
There has to be.
Filmation may have been cheap, but they weren't that cheap, Chris. Come on.
There absolutely has to be some danger for the barrel roll. They got to be going underneath something. Like, just picture Tom and Harry on their way to the holodeck to do Captain Proton, and Harry Kim just does a barrel roll.
Just for no apparent reason. Yeah. He's just
well, you got a barrel roll to
point.
Get into those caves.
I think maybe Harry thought the Delaney sisters were watching, and he was trying to impress them. So.
Now to get, heaven forbid, get serious, but wasn't the whole point of the barrel roll that he was going to duck under the phaser fire?
Of Harry's barrel roll here? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Sorry to jerk it all back to reality, but as real as this could be.
You realist.
Which Voyager was this? Was this the real one or the fake one? Okay.
Well, he did this barrel roll on the fake one, so I don't know if we are back in reality, Larry.
There you
so
go.
So is it a real barrel roll then?
Yeah, does it count?
Does any other franchise have podcasts where people are debating if it's a real barrel roll on the fake ship or not? Okay.
Trek FM. Well, actually, this is a whole new barrel roll.
Actually, Larry, I think the Dukes of Hazzard does probably.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because I know Bo and Luke did some barrel rolls.
Are you talking about the remake or are you talking about the...
I'm talking about the original one.
Just
and
kidding.
And also, it
just
doesn't
kidding.
Count. It does not count if Coy or Vance did it. Only Bo or Luke.
You know, you won't ever let me do Green Acres jokes.
I told you we could do a Green Acres podcast.
So how the hell did we get off doing
I told you that
Dukes
Matthew will have you on to do a Green Acres episode of the 602
okay,
Club.
Okay, okay.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Wow, or Northern okay. Exposure or anything.
Let's return to Deadlock here and talk about the parallel universe bit a little bit, because we're already talking about which is real and which isn't. At any point in this episode... Do you question which is our Voyager, meaning the one that we started out with as the Voyager we've been following for two seasons, and which is the duplicate?
See, I do not understand this debate of which one is real and which one is not, because to me, they are both real.
Agreed.
That's all. Drop the mic. I'm done.
Well, by real.
What,
I mean,
did this suddenly become a Metatrex episode?
Yeah, right.
I mean, they're duplicates. One is not lesser than the other.
No, Char. What I'm saying by real is...
Prime versus alternate.
we start the series with a Voyager.
Yes.
And
yes.
So for us as the viewer, we have our Voyager, which is what I'm referring to by real.
Yes, I know what you're referring to.
Created by
and it's the one that survives at the end.
Yes.
Because we couldn't run a whole series with a fake Voyager. That just wouldn't do.
See, I think it's they're both real because everything on it was duplicated except for the antimatter, right? It's like what happened with Riker in, what was it, Second Chances.
Second Chances,
right?
Yes.
He gets beamed, and he's an exact duplicate. And
right, the only thing that changes is the experience once the split happens.
Post-split.
Right. So I don't understand this. They're both real.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one's dead, one survived. The surviving one was the original point of view, so...
So technically it was the real one anyway then?
But so, Char, what would you think, as a Voyager fan, if the Voyager that was duplicated, the duplicate, there has to be one to start.
They all had goatees? What are you
yeah,
saying?
Yeah, right. A duplicate is created. If the duplicate survived and the Voyager that we had watched for almost two entire seasons was gone, would that change anything for you about the remainder of the series?
Not necessarily, although I know that a lot of people say that it's duplicate Harry going over to Voyager and duplicate Naomi. And I have a theory that if that's real, then that could explain why Harry seems to have this existential crisis throughout a good portion of the series where maybe it's stemming from trauma from this event.
It could. I mean, that's a good explanation.
There's a whole new layer of depth here to both Brannon and Garrett that none of us were just willing to, to them all these years.
Well, as Janeway says in the best line of the show, weird is part of the job.
Yeah. I think they should have followed this up where every time Janeway asks Harry to do something, he goes, "You're not my captain.
You're not the boss of me."
But at the same time,
on
it
a
was
quantum
kind of,
level.
It was funny that... she has to basically just bark at him to go. He's like, "But Captain, just go! I'm ordering you to live!"
I'm ordering you to live, yes.
For once. I mean, he died for one time, and then now he's being ordered to live, and then... The guy can't win. Whether he lives or he dies, he's either going to have the existential crisis or he's going to be dead. Poor Harry. Poor Harry.
Well, I mean, again, this gets back to the root of... I mean, all these topics we're talking about, a lot of this stems from... This was a Brannon show... I've got notes from my interview with Jerry for season two where she was like, "Oh, this is one of Brannon's great little weird shit shows that he started doing on Next Gen." And it's before Brannon was shouldered, it was like worn down with the mantle of being showrunner. So he could still be, weird little weird shit writer Brannon running around loose kind of a thing. No, I'm sorry.
I just see Brannon Braga kind of like running around the Hart building, I got a cool new weird shit idea, Jerry.
Okay, Brannon. Just write it long enough. But,
write the right board and,
But he's, but everyone, he'll say like, "Oh, I got to blow up the ship again in this show," like in Timeless and in, Relativity and, how many times can I blow up the how many times can I kill people off and bunk the staid Star Trek meme of what everybody expects, Like, we're talking about the characters dying and so from the, from cause and effect onward with Next Gen, anything like that he could tweak in a halfway responsible way to creating a drama that's engaging for people. And then, before we even get into the whole reset debate, because this really isn't a reset show. It's like having your weird shit and not having a reset button too cake or something.
Right. your weird shit.
Sounds like something on Neelix's menu.
You can have
your
weird shit cake and eat it
too. Right, exactly. So, So all these things we're talking about, and talking about killing the baby, I just remember the big fuss because people were so not thrilled with, I've gone blank on his name, the original Alexander on Next Gen, not the original, the little kid, but the one that played him most often.
Oh, Brian Bonsall?
He was such a holy, when he was like 5 and 6 and 7 and 8, when he was on the show, he was such a holy terror on the sets that they literally, and I always get Bloodlines and... adult Alexander at the very end of Next Generation. When they first wrote that show, they almost talked about having him permanently be an adult. And Jerry was like, "We're not taking a child's childhood away from him. I don't care who the actor is." And so so to have that be Jerry soft-hearted Taylor and even thinking that way about characters and what you were talking about, I forget if it was Brandon or Char talking about killing the baby off and having it be so shocking. It's almost like in intrinsically is shocking that way, because this is the show that, well, it's a show that barely had kids on it anyway. All these shows barely had kids, especially little kids. But that adds to it. That vibe is in there. That's baked into the DNA of the show, and especially she's still, you know, running it, and that's coming through in the writing between the lines. So, that does add to the shock.
Well, and of course, this is the very important kid, because it's the first one born on Voyager, and they never totally went through with the generational ship idea, but this was going to become the start of a trend, allegedly, and... It was an important occasion. We'd followed Samantha Wildman for she was pregnant for how many months with this kid?
I wish someone had figured this out. Char.
I wish someone had done the math on this, Char.
I actually did. So I was sitting there today, and I took the star date. So Caretaker was star date 48315.6, and Deadlock was 49548.7. So if you divide 1,000. Which is, you know, because it's 1,000 per year, by 12 months, and then you figure out that time frame, that's 14.8 months. So she was pregnant, if she got pregnant the day they left Deep Space Nine, she was pregnant for 14.8 months. And not only that, but she didn't even find out for 7.3 months that she was pregnant, because she told Janeway in Elogium, 4.8921.3.
Well, you know what,
now,
Brent?
You could argue that she just waited to tell Janeway.
Yeah. You know, because you want to get past that 7 months before you tell anybody, because otherwise, you know.
That poor woman. I'm sure all the mothers are just cringing at this thought. I mean, Samantha Wildman, what a trooper.
The other thing, Brandon, I just want you to know that Tuvok, his wife was pregnant for 14.9 months. So I'm just not so impressed with Samantha there.
And that wasn't even a mixed species pregnancy. That was standard by the book Vulcan.
And it was 7.4 months before Tuvok's wife even knew.
Yeah.
7.4 months. That's almost like the exact inversion of 4.7 months.
Yeah.
47
years, isn't it? You know, this is the craziest episode of I Didn't Know I Was Pregnant ever.
I didn't know I was pregnant.
That reminds me of a real side note. And Chris, if you want to cut this out. But you know, everybody's on the bridge at the start of the show, and they're waiting, and everything's just at a standstill, waiting for this kid to finally arrive. And I love that, because it is such a big, important thing for the crew. But Chakotay has this really kind of creepy line. He's like, "It's not even my child." And it's like, did anybody else have like a Maury show kind of flashback where, because he's got the whole thing with Seska at the same time where she's impregnated herself with his her DNA,
that,
or so but... she told him or thought. And it's like, oh, Chakotay, that was a horrible thing for you to say, buddy.
I didn't take it that way at all. I just took it, you know, he's the first officer of the ship, and so he's obviously nervous about.
Yeah, I mean, Robert Beltran, to his credit, delivers it a little more sincerely than that. But at the same time, just if you take it out of context, oh my God, dude, were you and Samantha having something?
I took the paternity test. It's not mine.
You are not the father. Chakotay.
Can I jump back?
Yeah, well, let's roll back for a minute here. And
I'm sorry.
I want to go back to the parallel universe idea here, because I did want to hear, Brandon, what you think about this part of the story.
Okay, so picture this. Okay, going back to kids and parallel universes here. Okay, twins, identical twins. Okay, so identical twins come from one egg, and something happens along the way to split them into two. And up until that point, they are one person. And then they split and become two. And that's how I see this. They are the same ship, and then they split. They have a small difference, and then one blows up. Had they both been going on, there would have been two ships for however many years, but one ended up blowing up at the end of the episode. But that's how I see it. It's the same ship until they have their difference. Their different.
Good analogy.
Thank you.
There you go. And no goatees needed.
No goatees needed.
With the blowing up part, I do have the question of, how can one Voyager explode and the Vidian ship explode, and then the other Voyager is just completely undamaged, but as soon as the explosion takes place, apparently exists in the same space as the other two ships once again?
I always blame that on the phase variance.
So the explosion corrected the phase variance?
Essentially.
Do we know what that phase variance was?
47 something.
I know that B'Elanna tried 5 times on 47 different frequencies get it in alignment.
It's just, they're just drowning in it about this time. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there's several 47 references in this episode, as well as and I counted them, 6 some kind of references, just for note.
I just imagine someone asking Chakotay, you know, where's the restroom? It's on deck 4. It's the 7th door on the left. That was just too much. They just crossed the line right there.
I think that the reason why the ship could blow up and the other one not blow up is the exact same reason that Worf was in Insurrection.
Well, what do you call that, Brandon?
That is the...
Did you guys listen? So we had Michael Dorn on the Orb recently, and we asked him if he has in his own mind an explanation for how Worf always ends up on the Enterprise. And he said no. He also thinks it's just ridiculous and that he felt that the writers just didn't give the fans enough credit. So, yeah.
Yeah, what the hell are you doing here? I don't know.
I don't know. If you didn't have Worf in Insurrection, you wouldn't have had those great Scorch lines, or Scorch, or whatever the hell that...
Yeah, those Klingons, they don't do anything small.
Klingon zits, yeah, because that would have just been a horrible loss to Star Trek canon.
Which makes me wonder, why, with all the licensed products that we have for Star Trek, why has no one ever done Klingon zit tattoos?
Oh, I thought you were going to say Klingon zit cream.
But yeah. Teenagers everywhere would love that.
When you have that really bad zit, you need Kronos cream.
Available by prescription only.
Gabla. Yeah.
Star Trek Insurrection is the reason that I will not read any spoilers anywhere. I was like, I had the internet when I was a kid, and I was surfing and trying to find information, and I found 2 pages of script online from Star Trek Insurrection, and it was the scene where Troy and Crusher were talking about their boobs firming up, and then it goes to Data, and Data was like, oh, and have you noticed how your boobs firm up? And I'm like, I shut my computer off. I'm like, this is garbage. This is absolute garbage. Then I went to the movie theater, and I'm watching the movie, and I'm like, no. No, I can't believe they actually just said this in a Star Trek movie. I thought, who could be cruel enough to post something that fake online, and then it was real.
And it was real.
So it was even worse.
It was even worse.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, I don't know. It never bothered me, although I thought a lot of the jokes were cheesy, but yeah. There you go.
Chris, going back to your...
Data's learning, so...
Yeah. I'm just doing some skimming here, and your bit about how you can't this show is such an example of Voyager leaning on tech for help. It's just funny to zoom through here because there's a whole sequence in Act 3 when they're trying to pad the length of this, and I just realized so there was originally a scene 41, which obviously went to a scene 42, and I was just looking the bit about where Kes has the visions and the voices. And she's woken up, and the doctor's like, what's going on? And she's having the overlapping voices of both dimensions about the baby dying and being born. Mm-hmm. That was technically scene AA41A. And I thought, oh, well, that was stuck in at the last minute, and it was. But even before that, there's a whole sequence of scene 41A, 41B, 41C, 41, all the way through scene 41, R? Yeah,
there's a 41R.
41A through 41R, and it's all the bits, it's the techie stuff where they can have people standing around and talking. This is a lot like, it's not quite like, oh my God, Warp 5 speed limit on TNG. I'm getting old, I can't think of it right off the bat. Natural, whatever the hell it was. But they're just, have you checked the so-and-so? Yes, I'm, there has to be a key. If they were recalibrating their carrier wave at the same time so we could match phase variants, would that allow us to connect? I think so. But in order to get them to do that, we have to communicate. It's the chicken and the egg. I mean, all of that stuff was like a last minute thing to pad out the script because they were taking it such a, again, David Livingston was directing it such a hellbent. So sometimes, isn't it kind of ironic though that the show that had the fastest pace has the padding in it to
Is it fast padding or slow padding? I don't know. I guess.
What's fascinating is how that actually worked. Because normally, if they kind of are padding out a script, you can maybe tell a little bit because it slows way down and it just doesn't quite fit. This seemed to really come together.
Well, the scene with Kes, I thought it worked perfectly fine, and it makes sense, especially what we learn about Kes by the time she actually leaves the ship. It makes sense that she would have these visions, and it supports the story just fine. At the same time, you could take that
scene
out.
She's the Guinan of the Delta Quadrant.
Yeah.
At the same time, you could take that scene out, and you wouldn't miss anything. Right?
True.
It's not critical to the story or the resolution, but it does fit just fine.
Now, force of nature.
Force of nature.
Before everybody starts writing in and telling me I've lost my mind.
The scene where they're finding out how to communicate with the other ship, though, what I noticed is that B'Lan is very concerned about them being able to actually send a message, and she says that probably the best they're going to be able to do is something no longer than 5 seconds. And so when they finally do send the message, Janeway does that thing where, this may not last very long, so I should probably get to the point of why I'm contacting you before I run out of time. And if I do run out of time, I'll try to find some way to contact you later, so just hold tight, but I might not have much time here. Like, you've already used up all your time, Kathy. And
then, it's like when my grandma calls and says, hey, I've just got one quick thing to tell you.
Yeah, right.
And it's an hour later when we hang up. Well, so I'm lucky.
It was going to be 5 seconds on January 4th, but by the time they got to February 2nd, they discovered they had, five or six more minutes they could
talk. They have plenty of time because...
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, okay, they found a way to go longer than 5 seconds. Maybe they can go 10, 15, maybe even 20 seconds. But then when Janeway on the damaged ship starts recounting her conversation with Janeway, we find out that she was told all kinds of details, and there's even a reference. I hope you caught this, Char. There's a reference to Mosaic in there.
Yes.
When
the
she says
match.
She even knew that I walked home 7 kilometers in a thunderstorm after losing a tennis match. Now, if that Janeway got to the point of saying, look, you can trust me because when we were a kid, we walked home 7 kilometers in a thunderstorm, she's obviously got a lot of time for a conversation here.
No kidding.
So how did they leap from maybe we can get 5 seconds in to this? It would be like in Cause and Effect if they found out that they could actually write a complete dissertation about the situation they were in instead of just indicating the number 3 everywhere on the ship, right?
Yeah, yeah. Clearly the technology worked a lot better than anticipated.
B'Elanna is a whiz.
She really is. She's very good at her work, yes.
Right. In fact, originally, Chris, when you said we were doing this episode, I thought you said dreadlock, and then I got confused.
Dreadlock?
Because I was thinking, because isn't that the episode where B'Elanna gets twinned because she has to go take apart the Cardassian missile gone wrong, and she can and gets blown up, but thankfully the real B'Elanna is able to go to the twinned Cardassian missile and undo it?
Maybe. I thought Dreadlock was the TNG episode where Guinan lost all of her hats.
Right, and the twinned alternate universe version of Geordi from the screen tests shows up.
Yes, that was dreadful.
That would have been awesome if Geordi
that
had dreadlocks throughout
the
entire
series.
That was
called Dreadful, is what that was called.
Thankfully, it was Dreadlock instead of Jerry Curl.
Oh, God. Yes. Well, I think before we totally leave this, I think it's interesting that he's in this. They tried this. Oh, we're going to upgrade our storytelling in second season while they were still, dragged down by the Kazon a little bit and got away from them. But Hogan is in this one, even after his arc as being a red herring, with the who's in with Seska and who's the Kazon spy and all that, which ended with alliances, because this deadlock is. Not dreadlock, but deadlock is about 2/3 of the way through the second season. So they've wrapped up that little thing. There's a few, some out of the blue.
It's episode
kind of,
21, so you've got like 5 more.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm looking at production because this is in the, we're holding four over, or UPN is making us
hold four over to start the next season early thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, technically, this is more like three-fourths of the way through the season. But they had Hogan in, which was kind of interesting, that he's still around just being and Simon Billig, the actor, is around for more than just that. And then, of course, he winds up a couple of times, and then he gets killed off in Basics Part 2, and then they use his bones in Distant Origin. And here's another one of these things that drove... I mean, one of the reasons why, even if I hadn't been standing here watching it so close from a front row seat here in L.A. by then, he was... his original Maquis... You know, he was a Maquis. His provisional little Maquis bar had him as a crewman, and then they would call him ensign at times, and they called him lieutenant here. And then when they had his uniform and they were calling him in Meld, they called him an ensign. I mean, it was like one of those little wacky things all over the place. But what I really thought was funny, years later, after Naomi is not only born here, but then instantly becomes 7 years old because, you know, she's an alien hybrid, of course, and they do that. Any alien species does that. Humans are the only ones that have gradual, you know, infant birth or development. I always thought it was interesting how Naomi Wildman was like had way more episodes than her mom ever did, you know.
Right.
And her mom didn't even die. I mean, her mom was around. She just disappeared and Neelix had to raise her.
Samantha Wildman kind of took a back seat after a while. Like, You're seven now. You can fend for yourself.
You've given us your baby. You can leave now.
There you go. Yeah, exactly. Like, here's the sonic shower. Here's the replicator. Make sure that you do your homework. Neelix will check up on you. I've got to go do bridge duty.
Yes. And Samantha, here is your certificate for helping repopulate the ship on our 70-year voyage. Now, please go back into the shadows again. And
just be careful with that replicator and don't request too many foods that contain a lot of cellulose.
Yeah, because we don't want yellowy food. That was in part of that whole long scene of they were riding at the last minute.
Okay, so they're trying to fill time, and they're like, what's wrong with the replicator? Last time we did this. How about it has trouble with foods with high cellulose content? Sounds good to me. Let's go with that.
Yeah, go with it.
Well, don't let those pages turn as yellow as the cellulose in the food. Okay, get them out there. No, the other weird thing about this is when they had the Vidians, and this is like alternating effects teams, the Vidian ship that they show in this is not the one from the Phage. It's the repto-humanoid ship from Parturition. And then they did come up finally and design a nice Vidian ship and use it later. But it's just like, you know, I'm back, and this is pre-CGI. But another little wacky thing I thought I'd throw in, on top of it being a blue screen city. And I was reading this interview with Kate where she's talking about how it was just so interesting to be, you know, blue screen, double screen, green screen. It was such a wacky little thing for her to be acting that way. And it's like, well, it is Star Trek, Kate. But, you know, weird. Double screen acting is just part of the job.
Sounds like an episode title right there. Well, it is Star Trek, Kate.
Yeah. It was probably still a little newish in that day.
So one other thing about the tech, we're kind of jumping around a lot because I want to jump on to the fact that Naomi Wildman was born here, but I want to go back to the tech for a minute. And this is sort of, I mentioned early on that, or maybe this was on the other side of the room, that the idea of the experiment that Janeway's talking about at Kent State University, you know, it sounds like Brannon is referencing some actual scientific news from the time in the 90s, because, you know, you do have these experiments all the time where people are able to transport a bit of matter from one place to another.
Right.
Those things happen. So it sounds kind of real, but
it's always announced in a story that leads with a reference to Star Trek.
Yeah, right. You gotta tie that in, of course. But this was actually a joke because Brannon went to Kent State University, and that's where he studied filmmaking, and so he referenced Kent State there. But I noticed in the story that the way they're trying to solve the problem with the antimatter leakage is through proton bursts. And the Kent State mascot is the Golden Flashes. So are the proton bursts Golden Flashes?
They must be.
Can you see them? Or actually, panels explode because of them. Those are definitely flashes.
That must be it.
See, Larry, I can work football into a Star Trek conversation.
You can. Well, I'm just glad for Kent. I'm just not to be a downer. I'm sorry. Anytime anybody says the words Kent State, I always think of the National Guard
you know, shooting of the students.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, anything that can get golden, and so the fact that their mascot is the Golden Flash, it's just like, no, let's forget that and just be happy, dappy, dappy. So I'm so thrilled they're experimenting with duplicating matter in the 24th, 23rd centuries. Anything that gets our minds into something a little more uplifting is fine by me.
This this Kent State experiment that failed, where they couldn't duplicate the antimatter, they could duplicate matter but not antimatter. The reason why they couldn't duplicate the antimatter was because it would turn into anti-time, and that's how we got the All Good Things episode.
Now that is high concept.
There you go.
Tying it all together.
Yeah. He wrote that one too, right? He wrote All Good Things, Brandon Braga.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So. 2 years before this, but
so that was Kent State, Q-E-N-T, right? Kent State.
That was the that's the Kronos University outpost campus. In,
All right. Well, let's we're at about 50 minutes or so right now, I think. So let's jump to a couple of other topics here. One, birth on Voyager. So Char, we were just talking about Naomi. And you mentioned earlier on that this was allegedly the beginning of an idea of having births on the ship. We've often talked about on the network here that in reality, a ship like Voyager stranded 70 plus years from home would have to become a generational ship. Otherwise, they're never going to make it back. You see that on Enterprise in E2 when the NX-01 gets thrown back in time. They understand immediately that they have to become a generational ship. And of course, we see that on Battlestar Galactica as well, on the new Battlestar Galactica. But Star Trek just didn't go in that way. But when you watched this initially, the first time, did you think maybe they were going to start having babies on the ship and take a slightly more realistic approach? Or did you just know, well, it's Star Trek, so somehow they're going to find a wormhole back or something?
I always hoped that Voyager was going to be a generational ship and kind of follow through with what they were talking about in Elysium, where we're going to need a little bit of a replacement crew if we really are going to be out here for 70-something years. I thought that's something that's going to make Voyager really unique, and they're going to have to deal with these problems, and that's a huge undertaking, bringing up children on a ship that's stranded so far out. And I thought, oh, how fascinating. It would have been a fantastic idea. And never mind the whole thing about having kids on set. I understand the logistics of that are very complicated and child actors can be very hard to work with and all of that. But the idea was fantastic. And I felt very shortchanged by the end of it when they didn't follow through hardly at all. There was Naomi, a couple of Borg kids, and then Miral born at the very end.
Well, and the Borg kids, they picked up. Right. Nobody.
Right. Yeah. Those weren't even born on the ship. Kids,
you know, no, that last Borg droneling is still stuck away somewhere in a canister down in deck 16 or whatever.
Borg baby.
Yeah. Remember the missing.
It's been one of the big mysteries of Voyager all this time.
Yeah. And I don't know if you noticed there, Char, but apparently baby Borg are called dronelings.
Yeah, I guess so.
You don't. That's not a term. Okay. That was the in-house term. No, that's what they called the babe. That's what they, the first couple times, they called the Borg kids dronelings on the call sheets and things.
Cool.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, we should have had a lot more things, like, you know, how Tom and B'Elanna got together. We should have had at least some sort of mention or even just visual representation, couples in the mess hall, and clearly they are, you know, together or something like that. Or, oh, so and so got engaged and they're going to, you know, we're planning a wedding in 6 weeks or something like that.
I blame
Why
it on.
Why didn't we get that?
I blame it on visual effects.
Really?
Yeah. Cause the same reason that pre-CGI days, people would criticize the fact that Voyager always looks so pristine, you know, that it wouldn't be dinged up and danged up and all that, because in the reality, they had a model and they couldn't be actually analogically painting on the model. And, you know, so I just blame that for visual effects.
Is that the reason, Larry? Because I always thought that Ensign Cooter down in engineering was fixing the ship during the commercial breaks.
Is that another Dukes of Hazzard joke? What is this?
See, the thing with having a generational ship and why it wouldn't have worked is, I mean, you know, you got 7 years. I mean, yeah, you didn't know that when they got to the Delta Quadrant it was going to be 7 years. But, you know, over a seven-year period, you're watching babies grow up to be 7 years old. And by the end of it, there's really not much that's been added to it other than, you know, some crying babies and changing diapers and stuff. But maybe one thing that would have worked if they wanted to do a generational ship was put some time in between seasons. Like, it doesn't have to take place over 7 years. It could have taken place over 40 years. Took them 40 years to get home. And, you know, there's like a 5-year gap in between seasons or something like that.
I just... We sit around and we think of those things today. I'm just trying to think of the 90s. Everything, I don't want to say it was so vanilla, but everything was so straight ahead, you know, nonlinear. I mean, they were trying to toy with things like limited arcs, you know, and DS9 was doing the same thing, was trying to toy with, this is all pre-Lost, in case, you know, for everybody who didn't watch these shows week to week. This was all before the big serialized storytelling boom and binge watching and buying DVDs and Netflix queues and all that. And they were trying to be, you know, breaking the mold that had been around since the days of, oh, we can't have, we have to have standalone shows because when the syndicated stations show them, people are going to just show up and they're, you know, the stations don't want to be told what order to put them in. And that was what guided that from, you know, original series onward. And they're trying to break out a little bit. And DS9 had a better time of it. I know Jerry just felt they were so clunky when they did the whole Seska running whodunit thing with Hogan and I forgot his name.
Jonas?
Huh? Yes.
Yeah.
But they were never. They always felt like they would write a show and then just cram that. There were several times when Jerry was very disappointed and thought that it just felt crammed in, and they were just clunkily handled. So they were trying to break out of where storytelling was in the 90s then, and not quite making it. So so some of these things they managed. So anyway, so I think some of those bits about. Your idea about stopping and like, oh, in between seasons, 5 years went by. That's such a routine thing that some of these series that are a little more out of the box with their storytelling now do. It may just have been a little, you know, too out of the box for them to do in the mid-90s.
Hannibal did that in the middle of its season 3 this year. Hannibal did that. It just, like, there's one episode and then the next episode's 3 years later.
Well, there you go. Well, there's Brian. Yeah, he would have wanted to do something like that probably back in the day, but they were, oh, Brian, that's too crazy. No.
I don't remember which season it was, but I remember that Desperate Housewives wrote themselves into a corner so much that the next season was like 5 years later, and they just had a tornado come through and destroy the town, and then they came back, and it was like 5 years later. It's like, we have no idea.
That's one way to do that.
We have no idea how to get out of what we've written. So we're just going to destroy the town and start over next season.
That's called retcon on the run. That's what that is.
And Larry, Jerry, she shouldn't just feel like maybe they crammed some stuff in. They literally would have an episode where for no apparent reason, they would show Jonas sitting there transmitting information to Seska and the Kazon, and then they would go back to the rest of the regular story.
So Seska, I learned how to play Klingon dominoes tonight. Okay, great. Okay, yeah. No, I know.
Yeah,
what you
I didn't
meant.
Say the information he was transmitting was important information.
That's what I mean. Yeah,
just, right. Just some information.
Okay, so tonight Neelix burned the Alturian waffles, and there was nothing for dinner. Thanks, Jonas. Yeah.
That would be so awesome. And then on her ship, the Maa is just like, "Can't you ever bring me anything useful, Seska? Come on." All right.
Oh, so the poor second season. Okay.
Let's talk about Vidians for a minute. I'm really curious what you guys think about the Vidians, because when the episode starts and they start talking about Vidians, I'm thinking that, well, Samantha's giving birth. The Vidians are really going to want this baby because chances are there's something they can get from the baby that's really going to help them cure the phage. You know, just like Spot's babies helped save the ship in Genesis. And so I'm thinking that that's where they're going to go. And then we don't hear about the Vidians anymore until the end of the episode. Once the Janeways have decided what their plan is going to be, well, then the Vidians show up to make everything difficult. So it feels very much to me like they just put the Vidians in the beginning of the episode so that they could pull them back in at the end as a solution to the problem of how to force the hand of the Janeway of the undamaged ship to make the decision that you didn't expect, which was to destroy the ship that was in the better condition instead of the ship that was so damaged being destroyed.
But, see, I like that. I like that part of it, you know? I think it's cool.
Yeah, I like that twist.
I think it's cheap writing, personally. I think it's like...
You just thought they got short-shifted.
I feel like it's a cop-out. I mean, it's like you're...
Really? I didn't see it that way at all.
It's as if they had an entire story. Like, you could write this story without the Vidians at all. And then you get to the end and you say, how are we going to solve this? How are we going to force the hand here and have the resolution that we want? Well, we need someone to come and make it difficult so that Janeway on the good ship, for lack of a better word, has no choice but to destroy the ship because we need to save our ship. This is going back to the beginning when we had the debate about whether one ship's real and one's not real. But the ship that we entered the story with as being our Voyager is the one that's more damaged, and it's the one that's going to be destroyed. Well, they need to find a way to save that ship. So you have to have some other element enter the story to change the situation. And so you bring in the Vidians. So then you could go back to the beginning and you could just write that little bit about, oh, there are 20 Vidian ships up here and there are a couple of Vidian populated planets. Then you can use them at the end of the story. So it felt to me like they were never really needed as part of the story and it was just a cheap solution. But that's my interpretation. I think
I actually wrote that
like
on my page.
5 pages of notes about it here. And I think Larry also might have information that is different than what I'm feeling. But anyway, that's my feeling as the viewer. So,
see, I liked it because to me, like, they introduced the Vidians. And, you, like, again, this whole episode is about misdirection, you know, and it starts off and it's like, okay, we're having a baby and things are okay. We're going to expand our population. And it's like, oh, crap, we got the Vidians. And I mean, the Vidians are a pretty interesting race. That's one of the races that I really liked about Voyager. I thought it was unique. I thought it was original. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought that they looked a lot like what I pictured Neelix's vaporized pot roast to look like from this episode.
Well, the Vidians in this episode, I thought that these guys were, if the California Raisins from those commercials in the 80s, if they came back today to do new TV spots, they would have aged, you know, so much. I think they would look a lot like the Vidians in this episode.
Or like a modern reboot of the California Raisins. A dark reboot. But
they are rebooting everything.
Yes. In the reboot, instead of the California Raisins helping your body, they want to just take parts of your body.
And shut the organs down. Well, I agree with Brendan. I thought that we all know about the Great Kazon debacle. Although the idea that there was going to be the gangs of space was kind of interesting, but it just got so clunkily brought to real life. But I just, it's to be not the big, you know, hoo-ha, the villains that we introduced in the pilot to be our season-long, you know, our series-long running villains, and they weren't, thankfully. But I just thought the Vidians, just, you know, conjured up on the run, were one of the best alien species and adversaries. I hate saying villains, because they weren't really villains. They totally had a culture-wide motivation. Even though they were bad guys and adversaries, they were also sympathetic at the same time.
I agree.
And I just thought that was a really interesting thing. So any time to see the Vidians, even if they weren't in the right ship, I enjoyed it. And their little they didn't keep up with them. And then, you know, after 2 or 3 years. I mean, it's one more thing of Voyager, of all the series, Voyager is the one that had the most turnover of the showrunners. It's like you start off with a war of too many at first, and then it goes from, you know, Michael and Jerry to Jerry, then Jerry and Brandon coming, and then Brandon, and then Ken runs last year. And a lot of these continuity canon things we talk about and we pull our hair out over is because of that, without even blaming any one person. Yeah. It's just the fact that it churned over so much. But... the Vidians kind of, part of that was that whole thing about we're moving on and we're leaving the Vidians behind, and they became a thing for flashback shows, you know, and Shattered and that kind of thing. But I always thought they were one of the best species with a backstory ever made. And the fact that they finally got cured at the end was kind of cool.
But remember, though, I'm not talking about the Vidians themselves, because actually we've done a show, we've talked extensively about Vidians before, and I agree that I do think they're one of the better villain races because of exactly what you said. They are sympathetic at the same time. Like, you can kind of understand why they're doing what they are. I'm just talking about their use in this particular episode.
No, structurally, right.
Structurally, I felt like they introduced them just for a solution instead of them being part, because if there was ever a story where it would make more sense for the Vidians to be a big part, it would be the Vidians have detected that, and maybe they have some kind of intelligence, or who knows what kind of, you know, their little two-pronged sensors they wave over people. Maybe they knew that this baby was going to be born, and they really wanted to have that baby.
Those are called bioprobes.
Bioprobes, yes.
Yes.
To finish my thought from earlier there, but like the episode is about misdirection, and they mention the Vidians, and then they try and get away from them, and all this bad stuff happens, and then you forget about them. You forget the Vidians are there, you forget that they were mentioned and whatnot, but they were mentioned in the episode, right? And bang, at the end they come back and it's like, holy smokes, I completely forgot about the Vidians. And there's this threat that they were trying to evade in the first place when all this bad stuff started to happen. So I don't know, I thought it was really cool myself.
Yeah, I totally agree. You nailed why that works, like the whole Vidian plot works for me, because we introduce them, they move course a little bit, and then all this stuff happens, and then you're so caught up in that the first time you're watching it that you forget that the Vidians were the reason why they moved around in the first place, and then you're like, oh yeah, that's happening too, oh boy. So it's just another dimension to me. I don't see it as a cop out at all.
And what
it seems fluid to me.
And what's interesting, just a new layer, just as we kind of prep for this show, to me, and even reading the script more so than even watching the show, was in the mid '90s. We did not yet have the great, you know, zombie craze and The Walking Dead and everything else. And it's almost like the Vidians are a function of. I mean, you know, aside from Dinara Pell, you really never got. The Vidians were just the same thing that made them sympathetic here as a culture. Also, they're a little bit like Borg. There were never any individualized Vidians, really. They tried to do that with the first time out, but it's kind of hard to do that when they don't. It's kind of hard to be a human actor, even dealing with a mask approach to acting with all that muck on your face of different kinds. So, aside from Dinara, you never got to humanize these. So, they always were just, you know, marching minions around. And so. Even though they're sympathetic or whatever, but they do create a lot of suspense, like in this show. And you wind up the show. It basically came around where I was thinking, wow, these are today. If this was done today, people would be calling these the sentient zombies, because everyone's running, it's screaming. There's this inevitable, you know, just the inevitable march of being. How long can we hold out against them? We're barricading. We're backing up. We're, you know, just that whole anti-zombie feel. Only they have a brain, and they're trying to fulfill a mission. They're doing functional things with tools and things. They're not mindless zombies. But anyway, with all the hoo ha about the Enterprise zombie, Vulcan zombies, that's what 20 years later did watching this. I just had that, you know, impression laid on top of what we knew already. But no, the Vidians were in here and they're there, and we're never going to get, like I said, we're never going to get a humanized one. So their function here was pretty much what you'd expect. Didn't take away the show for me.
I think Sulan in Faces would be another Vidian that we really get to know. And he's actually the reason why I agree that the Vidians are sympathetic in a way as well. That story.
Right. Like I said, when they were introduced, that was kind of the closest you got. And then after that, they, you know, never.
So, all right. Well, I still feel my way about it, but I understand what you guys are saying as well. I'm curious to know, you know, people listening, how they feel about the Vidians in this particular story as well.
Chris, you know, can I just say, the way this poor show started off huge, and then they cut it back for budget, and then David kept like throwing in extra explosions and phaser hits, and then they had to write all that holes. It's amazing this poor show even hangs together at all. So quit your wheezing, okay?
Well, it does hang together well, and I do think it is a very interesting story. I haven't actually ranked, you know, like what's my favorite 10 Voyager episodes in a long time, but this isn't my favorite Voyager episode, but it's up there amongst those because, again, like I said, I do like parallel universe stories. I like alternate reality stories. And this is one where we talked about Voyager maybe relying on technobabble in this episode, in some sense, to extend scenes because they were running short. But this is a time where I don't feel like they're relying on technobabble to try to just tell a story and make something work where they didn't really know what to do with it. Here, I think the technobabble actually supports the story because it is a very technical story in the first place. And so that all works pretty well for me here. Also,
adjust your tricorders for spatial anomalies. Yeah.
Yes, press the big spatial anomaly button. Yeah. Put it into anomaly mode.
That's the Mark 47 tricorder. That's what that is.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have one thing left on the outline, but I think we already talked about it pretty much all we need to earlier on, which was the fact that Harry Kim is the Harry Kim from the alternate universe. And so is Naomi moving forward. So let's go ahead and jump into our final thoughts and our rating here, because we have passed an hour. So, Char, what are your final thoughts and your rating on Deadlock?
My thoughts are that this is one of the best put together episodes of season two of Voyager. I feel like it's a very strong science fiction story. It's intriguing. And I was surprised to learn just how many revisions there were.
Yeah,
because
right?
This seems to come together so incredibly solidly. It's not quite the Yesterday's Enterprise of Voyager, but you know, it kind of sounds like it was at that kind of just white hot speed and whatnot. And they didn't know what in the world they were going to, like how it was going to come out in the end. And it turned out, you know what? It was quite all right. I think you can't go wrong when you've got that combined with a very fast paced story. It does move very well. A lot happens. And you get two Janeways as well. And hey, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I think that's a lot of fun. Janeway arguing with Janeway is one of the best things that happens on Voyager. It's so good. I mean, because she would. She totally would.
She would totally argue with herself.
Yeah.
It's too bad this is a concept they never explored again. Gee.
Right? Oh, darn, yeah. So I think I actually blame Deadlock, the fact that Kate Mulgrew did such a great job playing two Janeways that we do get what we get later on. But anyway, it's a great story. And finally, Samantha Wildman gives birth to this baby that has incredible ramifications down the line for Voyager and its story. So I consider it must-see Trek. An essential Voyager, and even if you're not watching it for continuity, it's still a really good standalone episode. So I'm going to give it 4 disheveled buns of steel.
That's written as BOS with a D in parentheses before the BOS, right?
Kind of like IMDb, yeah.
Yeah, all right. Awesome. Brandon, how about you?
I love this episode. It's my favorite episode of Voyager, and every time I watch it, I remember 15-year-old Brandon watching this and my mind being blown away watching this episode. I'm just like, what is going on? This is crazy. Oh my goodness. And I don't know. I just love it. And it's never dipped at all. There are two things in this episode that I don't like, and they are both lines by the Doctor. And I wrote them down. The first one is when he says, "I'm sure your Voyager is also equipped with a proficient emergency medical hologram." And the other one is when he goes,
"Don't like that line."
I don't like that line because again, like my point of view is this is the same ship, and it splits. So yeah, of course there's another Doctor there because there was another Doctor there 15 seconds ago. But when you guys split,
exactly.
And the other one is right at the end when he turns to Kim and he's like, "This other Doctor, did he have a name? I really didn't have time to ask." I don't know. It's just like, I think it's a cheesy line. So.
Yeah, but this was at the point where they were...
Well, it kind of counteracts what he says, too.
Yeah, I know.
But this was at the point where they were still playing with the idea of maybe giving the Doctor a name. So
I know, and I know why they did it. Yeah. But it's like, no, did you have a name 30 minutes ago? No, because you still don't have one. So
see,
unless he decided, and especially while he was doing triage care, you know, the brink of a crisis, that's a really good time to come up with the name. Yeah, sure, do that.
Yeah, my name.
I still have to say, and maybe this is a conversation that we'll have to continue in the Babel conference, but the position that you guys have that it's the same ship, and what you're saying right here, Brandon, I'm not sure that I can agree with that, because if you look at Second Chances, it would still be like saying that Thomas Riker and Will Riker from that point forward are still the same person, but they're not. They were duplicated. They were the same person. It was one person. They were duplicated. Then they continued on. There are two in existence. And if these two Voyagers are the same ship, then you can't have two actual ships in existence, even in the same space.
Somebody speed dial Zach and Mike right now.
This would be a good topic for Metatrex, right?
I think they mentioned it on there a little bit. They did mention Thomas Riker a little bit.
I don't know what's right. I don't know what's wrong. I don't know the exact explanation for it. But for me, I don't know that I can completely see that it's just the same ship. Because they could have continued on for who knows how long as two separate ships.
Right.
With separate from that points, events happening.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Say if they found an antimatter source just magically out of thin air, who knows? But
yeah, they could have been both going on and then would have double the chances. But I see what you're saying. I do see what you're saying. I just think that they're the same ship. So
yeah, well, I'm curious, who amongst our listeners, who feels one way, who feels the other. Great topic for the Babel Conference.
For sure.
On Facebook. Type B-A-B-E-L into the search field and come talk to us about it.
No, I want to talk about it at the real Babel conference, on
the real one, okay.
The planetoid, codenamed Babel.
I will say they do have a better buffet spread there than we do.
That's true.
Yeah.
So I'll give my rating.
So what's your rating, Brandon?
5 out of 5, 2 Vok damage reports.
Extensive.
I was going to say that's a very extensive rating, Brandon. Thank you for that.
And the baby died.
All right, Larry, how about you?
This is why it's good to not hole away in the ivory tower too many times, because you guys actually made me get out of Voyager and watch it. it's including one that was just like another episode on the shelf to me. And I don't mean that totally facetiously. I love to hear what makes everybody excited about different Brendan here in this case, but I just love hearing what people do, because it's a great way not to just be same old, same old, and moldy, oldy, and hear people's fresh takes on things, because it is a fresh take. So this one that was stored away in my brain is, the one with the doubles and Kim and Naomi are fakes from now on. And that's how it was stored away in my brain. And it was the most color wheels on the page changes. It's been good to air this out, and I still bat down your poor Vidian wheeging over there, Chris, but it is a good show, and it did have a lot of drama, and it really did hang together as a miracle. They really pulled it off, and I guess in short, there are only a few painful parts of the show, so I'm going to give it 4.7 exocranial ridges lodged in the uterine wall out of 5.
Ouch.
Oh, man.
Very, very painful rating right there.
Well, painful is just part of the job, Chris.
Because we're Starfleet officers. Yeah, well, that brings me to one of my final thoughts, Larry, which is that I think that the fetal transport is the 24th century C-section. And I also think that it's probably not a good idea to beam a fetus and a newborn baby out of the womb. Because if you think about what the transporter allegedly does, which is to basically destroy all of your cells and reconstitute them somewhere else, probably not a good thing to do to a newborn. But I also wonder if Voyager has a special alert color for fetal transport. They have blue alerts for landing on a planet. I think maybe like an orange alert for a fetal transport.
Oh, I was thinking
operation.
Pink alert, but yeah, or something.
Yeah. Well, if it's a girl.
Which apparently Samantha Wildman refused to find out during the whole 14 months of her pregnancy, because she says, I really thought it would have been a boy.
Even today, it can be difficult to avoid finding out what the gender of your baby is, right?
My son and daughter-in-law are just right now in this very moment, and they just decided to not do that. And we're all kind of laughing about what. So when the ultrasounds come in and it's something's right in your face, you're just going to ignore it? Yeah. Hope it's a skin tumor or something? What are you going to do?
And so you have to imagine that in the 24th century, it must be extremely difficult to avoid finding out the gender of your baby. But about pink alert, once upon a time, pink was the color for boys. Right now, it's the color for girls. Maybe by the 24th century, pink is for boys again. So,
I was totally thinking just non-genderist, you know, color of baby skin. That's all I was thinking when I said pink alert. So I didn't mean to exclude baby blue or assign gender roles or anything like that. So,
pink is the color for half-catarians in the future.
Yeah. There you go.
We could go down that path of which Katarian is this, but we won't go there.
Sounds it's like a game show. Which Katarian is this? Are you smarter than a Katarian?
There you go.
Wasn't there Katarian apples? Didn't they have Katarian apples in the original series?
Katarian apples.
Let's go for Katarian.
Yeah, but Katarian.
There were Katarian eggs in Generations.
Yes.
Katarian apples.
Because Katarian started with the game, but then by the time they made the boxer in the boxing show with Cachote.
Cachote.
Gesundheit.
Yeah. Bless you. By the time they made that a Katarian, and then the unseen husband, and she has dots on her head who they didn't... I mean, it was like, okay, is this an Alpha Quadrant Katarian? Is it a Delta Quadrant Katarian?
Exactly, because apparently some of those Katarians decided not to try to take over the Federation and instead became Starfleet officers.
Right, got sucked away by the caretaker. And,
by the way, Brandon, Katarian apples are difficult to eat because they're very spiky.
Mm.
Yeah. You can get it lodged in plenty worse places than your uterine wall.
All right. So, I enjoy this episode very much, and I'm a little bit critical about a couple of the story elements, but overall, it's really fun. It's a fun episode to watch, and I'm going to give it a pancreas, a clavicle, and a pelvis.
Interesting.
Okay.
I may think the Vidians were not used well in the episode, but they did give me my rating. So
I'm sorry, Chris, but Body Parts was a show on DS9.
True. All right. So thanks for joining us today, Char and Brandon. Before we let you go, tell everyone where they can find you around the interwebs. How about you, Brandon?
I just recently activated a Twitter account because of all of you guys. So I could follow you back a little bit more.
Yay, join the party.
So you can find me at Brandon Matella. That's BrandonMutala. And you can find me all the time on the Babel Conference. I've been posting a lot of pictures of the covers of the comic books that I've been reading. But I'm on there talking quite a bit. And I'm on Facebook at Brandon Shea Matella. So my first name is actually Brandon Shea. So...
Brandon Shea. Okay, Brandon Shea.
But Brandon's fine.
I'm sure you get a lot of people who call you just Brandon, right?
My friends call me B-Shea.
B-Shea. All right. Mm-hmm. From now on, you shall be B-Shea.
Sounds good.
On Trek FM. Okay.
Nice. Now we know.
Now we know. The more we know. All right. Dun, 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 dun. Thank you. And Char, how about you?
Well, you can find me with Tristan Riddell on To the Journey.
To the journey!
To the journey!
Yeah, that's right. New episodes come out every Thursday. We talk all things Voyager, including Deadlock, but everything else as well. And so if you like Voyager, if you're not listening to our show yet, what are you waiting for? Give that a listen, and hopefully you like what you hear. Otherwise, I am on Twitter. My handle is OhTheProfanity. And you can also find me on YouTube doing tutorials for... do-it-yourself, just like kind of homemade bath products right now, and I'm hoping to expand eventually, but as I drink the vodka, you have to watch and see what happens, and it's been a good time. It's something I hope that will catch on and maybe help me start a small business, so please check that out if you're interested.
I think people are waiting for you to accidentally drink the bath product because you have been drinking too much vodka while you do that.
I've heard some comments like that, and I realize I need to drink a lot more than I have for some of the tutorials I've filmed already because they're far too coherent. And I'm going to have to do one drink before I start taping and then during and then do a couple at a time and really get things going that way. Yes. Yes.
You could have Voyager motto for your bath products. Don't throw the half-Katarian baby out with the bathwater.
Hey, that's good. I'll consider that for the future. if you want to look up information just for the bath and body products, that's profane handmade products. That's what I'm calling them because of the profanity.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Okay. Thanks again, guys, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, Larry, that was a really interesting discussion about a really interesting episode. And I hope I didn't upset everybody too much with my Vidian talk there. But I think we can all agree that it was a great Voyager outing.
It was. It was so cool to see a little baby alien infant with a goatee.
And horns.
And horns.
You know, that baby looked really comfortable, though. I was surprised when Samantha's holding the baby, even when the doctor's holding the baby, really seemed very at peace and like it didn't mind having three horns glued to its forehead.
Well, if you're jumping quantum universes, you are not exactly at your grouchiest either.
That's right. So I'm glad Shar and Brandon could join us. And if you'd like to share your thoughts on the episode, we would love to hear from you. As I mentioned during the show, the best place to go for a discussion with the hosts on the network and the other listeners is in the Babel Conference on Facebook. That's a closed group just for our listeners. The way you get there is to type B-A-B-E-L, Babel, into the search field on Facebook. You'll need to click join and we'll let you right in, but we have great conversations over there that are very much like the ones we have here on the show. You can also find us on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. Our main page on Facebook is facebook.com/TrekFM. You can send us a message through the website by going to trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that'll come to me by email. And you can even send us voicemail by going to speakpipe.com/TrekFM. Now, Larry, when you're not trying to figure out if you're really yourself or maybe you came from an alternate reality and you're not the Larry Nemechek that everyone thinks you are, where can people find you?
You mean when I'm the Larry Nemechek that actually cheers for the Shorthorns?
Then I know Yeah. It's really not you.
crossing streams again there. No, I guess the best place, Central Hub, is still LarryNemechek.com. And Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Facebook and at Larry Nemechek on Twitter. Of course, there's Facebook pages and things for my documentary, The Con of Wrath, and you can still support that through PayPal and the Trekland trunk, where we bring pieces of my archival studio things out and some really old retail things at times. And those are out shared on eBay and our little live and local Sunday auction we have with our regular cast of alien bidders. You'll have to see it to believe it. And of course, now, aside from Geek Nation Tours and Enterprise in Space and all the other wonderful projects I like to be a part of, Portal 47 is kind of front and center, and I'm really, really working hard on building that up. And portal47.net, it's your insider access to a savvier fandom, even more than what you can get here. Even more, once you're a Patreon fan and you're a supporter of all the Trek FM shows, we can take it even to the next level, thanks to, you know, my memories archives and my Rolodex. And Vince Dedrick is one of those guys. And I'm just looking forward to all the great things that 2016's going to bring along and hope everybody can join us with that too.
Yeah, exciting year for Star Trek for sure.
Yes. Oh, and some other stuff happening in Star Trek too, I guess. Yeah,
yeah, some stuff like that. So so everyone go check all that out. And again, don't forget that Larry has the Cyber Monday extension on his deal there through December 7th. And check out all of that stuff. Again, I'd like to remind everyone again about the Trek FM store as well. Trek.fm/store or trekfm.link/trekfmstore. Those will both take you over there where you can access the store on Redbubble. And check out the holiday gifts that we have available for you guys over there. I'd also like to remind everyone about Patreon. We are a listener-supported network, and we do need your help to keep the shows coming. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, you can find out everything you need to know about how you can support the network. And also the perks. We have a great website called Patron Zone at patron.zone, which is just for our patrons. And that has all of our perks available to you all the time. So you don't have to wait until a certain day to get access to this stuff. You just go over there. If you are a patron, you'll get the password. It changes every month. And you can get early access to some of our shows. You can get other exclusive content, wallpapers, avatars, ringtones. We have all kinds of stuff for you there on that website. And you can also become an associate producer for the network for your favorite show. And some of our associate producers have even gone on to appear on the shows that they support. And a few of them have even formed their own show here on the network.
Those uppity fans.
So we have great opportunities for you if you are a supporter of the network, and we really thank everyone who does help us keep the shows coming. I'd especially like to thank our associate producers for this show, The Ready Room, and those are Renee Roberts and Zachary Fruling. You can find Renee on Twitter at @Mares_1701 and Zachary at Zachary Fruling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. That's his name on Twitter, as well as his name in real life. And you can find him over there. So thank you, everyone who supports us. And if you'd like to find me, I'd love to talk to you about Star Trek. You can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. That's also my name on Facebook and pretty much everywhere else. And you can find me in the Babel Conference. Elsewhere on the network, you can find me doing The Orb with Matthew Rushing, which is all about Deep Space Nine. I also do our short news show Hyperchannel from time to time, and Continuing Mission, which is about fan films and independent productions. If you'd like to read my writing about Star Trek, you can find that on the official website at StarTrek.com. And I also do a podcast that has nothing to do with Star Trek called Metropolis On Air. I know, Larry, it's hard to believe, right? I do talk about things besides Star Trek sometimes.
Or Bama football.
And you can find that show on iTunes and in other places by searching Metropolis On Air. And that's about life in Tokyo and also about entertainment. And I do interviews with people in a wide range of fields, and we do language tips and all sorts of stuff like that. So it's kind of a fun show. So check that out if for some reason you just like to hear me ramble on about things when I'm sitting in front of a microphone. All right. Well, thanks again to Char and Brandon for joining us today. And Larry, I'm going to wander on down to deck 15. I want to see if that spatial rift is still open, because I think my class ring might be over there on the other ship.
You do that, Chris, because you know what? It's time to stick 47 extra script pages in it, because the Ready Room is done.